Are you good on time?
You know, just looks like it's 7:31.
So. Why not? Like, we tried it.
30.
We tried it.
Okay. Okay, good morning. Let me have everyone grab a seat, if you would, please, and we'll begin the study session. This is Thursday, October 5th, 2006. We have the topic, basically, of immigration today on our study session. And I would like to make it known that this is a study session, and we are having some information presented to us on the city, federal, state, county level of what's taking place on immigration. We also have some representatives from the governor's office here this morning to let us know what's taking place on the state, but we will not be having public comment on the individual items here this morning. If we do suggest an action to go back to staff to do more research, if there's a resolution or ordinance that is in draft form, at that point we will accept public comment on those on the subject matter and solicit public input at that time. But this will not be the forum for a public comment this morning. I just want to let you know. We do have a maximum of three people at the end of the meeting for public comment, as we typically do, but at that time the discussion from this morning will have been concluded. So I just want to let everyone know what the ground rules are here today. Our first item of eight that we will be going through is to hear a presentation and discuss an overview on the state's efforts to address illegal immigration. Mr. Healing, you want to introduce us?
Thank you, Mayor, members of the council. With me today, to my far right, from the Governor Napolitano's administration, is Susie Barr, the Deputy Director of Legislative Affairs and Policy Advisor for Law Enforcement with the Governor's Office. And beside me, Lisa Morrison, the Director of the Department of Liquor and License Control, and also heading up the Arizona's Fraudulent ID Task Force. And they are here to present an overview of the administration's efforts on both immigration and border security. And I'm going to turn it over to them.
Great. Good morning. Thank you, Mayor and Council, for having us here today to discuss an overview of what the state and Governor Napolitano is doing as far as border security is concerned, as well as in the state, as well as the federal level. With time at hand, I know I only have about 15 minutes to discuss this, which is not that much to discuss such a broad issue. So I'm only going to be touching on a few of the state's law enforcement initiatives that Governor Napolitano has begun over the past year. I always start, though, with the caveat that these initiatives, and I know I'm preaching to the choir when I say this, as I've read recently in the paper, that these do not take the place of the federal government. We still strongly believe that this issue is the federal government's responsibility, and it's disappointing to the state that this past session Congress was unable to pass an actual comprehensive immigration reform package. They passed bits and pieces. They passed a lot in the end. And with regards to enforcement, which is great, I mean, whether you look at a fence, an actual fence or a virtual fence, we always support more technology down at the border. But that's only one part. And that part has to be fully funded, and it has to actually work, and we don't know if that's going to happen. But at the same time, a fence is not a comprehensive package. It also has to deal with the economic impact in this state and in Mexico with the ideas of a guest worker program. So with that said, I've passed out some materials. So you'll find them in your blue packet. And this is just an overview, gives you somewhat the first thick packet. Just gives you somewhat of an overview of what the governor's done to try to get the federal government engaged in the state of Arizona, not only encouraging them to pass a comprehensive reform package, but also to bring resources, federal resources, to the state. I'll just point your attention to just a few. The top three sheets in this packet is an overview. It's an overview of what the state has done this year alone in in anything that she's done related to the border, border security, or border reform. And I don't think I missed anything, but it's mostly what she's done in joint efforts with other border states and as well as herself. These documents include items like in the top of the list, you'll see in contact 14, item number 14, which is the MOA that the governor signed to bring the National Guard to the border. The governor was the first governor to go to the president and ask for the National Guard to come to the border over a year ago. He listened to her, DHS listened to her, and it actually took place just a few months ago, actually around April or so. And now we have anywhere between, the number varies, but anywhere between 2,000 and 2,100 National Guard on our border, which has been a successful initiative on the federal government's part, and we support that. I'll also point your attention to items number three, which is very important. This just happened in this last August. The governor attended the National Borders Border Governors Conference. This conference takes place with all the border governors on this side of the border and all the border governors on the Mexican side of the border. And out of that came a letter from the border governors on this side, a very strongly worded letter urging Congress to pass comprehensive reform. Obviously, that didn't happen, but it's something that you guys might be interested in. I know there's a letter floating around here today that's talking about sending a letter to Congress about comprehensive reform. So that's what the governor did. She also did that in her joint letters in number 12 and 13 with Arnold Schwarzenegger. They sent it to the Senate and the House. And this not only talked about comprehensive reform, but also talked about reimbursement to the state. And this is another issue that we talk about frequently, is reimbursement costs to the state. In these two letters, not only does she refer to, there's many comprehensive programs that they have passed, that they have enacted, that are supposedly assistance, state impact reimbursement programs, grants, assistance that they're supposed to provide the state for all immigration related, federal related activities that we take on as a state because they're not taking action. And we are constantly in contact with them, constantly pounding them. We have yet to see reimbursement, but we continually write letters like this in conjunction with other border governors who don't see reimbursement either. If you turn to the last page, or the last couple pages in that packet, there's also something that is a federal law that requires the feds to reimburse for state prisoner costs of illegal immigrants. And it's called SCAP. And the governor, they had not been, basically what they've been reimbursing the state is pennies to the dollar. So what we did is she wrote a letter, as you can see, to Attorney General Ashcroft back then, explaining the statute, explaining the reimbursement process, explaining the state had not received the funds. And then she decided to type up an invoice, which is also included. And this invoice basically lays out what they owed us. It was a bill for, back then, I think, $200 million. I think it's raised to somewhere around $250 million now. And she sent it on. And she got a letter back from, you know, a mid-level person at the Department of Justice. And what she says is it didn't really include an explanation of why there was no reimbursement, and it didn't include a check, which is what she was really looking for. So she followed that invoice up with another invoice, and she follows it up with monthly invoices as the numbers just keep on rising as our state costs. I mean, it's expensive to house these individuals, and it's not, according to, you know, the law is not our responsibility. The invoice that she sent most recently attached a late fee, which we found humorous in our office. They didn't really, but they're late. So anyway, this is just to give you an idea of how we try to get the feds engaged in our state issues and how we try to get reimbursement. Now, what we've done on the state level to fill the gap as far as enforcement is concerned, we've done many things. And in the process of doing these things, we have been and started to be in constant contact with the border leaders in the state, the border sheriff, the border police chief, and the border mayors, to really listen to what they have to say before we craft these initiatives, because I think that's important, and I think it's the reason why most of these initiatives have become successful over the past year, is because it's really what this state needs down at the border, and those are the professionals that really know the issues. So about a year ago, in talking to these border leaders, they came to us and said that, you know, their budgets were being crippled. Their budgets were being crippled by their enforcement costs and their resource cost, both enforcement-wise and everything-wise related to illegal immigration and immigration costs. So what the governor decided to do at that point, which was back in August, she declared a state of emergency in the four border counties across the Arizona-Mexico border, and that freed up $1.5 million in order to basically not alleviate but help in their financial burden and give them resources for officer overtime, officer resources, and this is what they really needed at that time to assist them in, you know, just what was crippling their budgets at the time because nobody had really addressed it up to that point. At the same time, we had to use our state resources to do whatever we could to fill this gap in the state. And at the same time, she directed her Department of Public Safety to come up with a comprehensive enforcement strategy of where the problem was really stemming from. And this goes to three main key points. One, she told them they needed to look at where was this stemming from of human smuggling and human drug trafficking. And that really was these large criminal organizations, syndicates that are in Mexico, that have counterparts here, that are wire transferring money through our Western unions. We have several hundred Western unions in the state. And we basically realized that this was the hub of human smuggling and human drug trafficking. It was a sad fact to realize, but we knew we had to go after it. When Governor Napolitano was Attorney General, she actually drafted anti-terrorism legislation, which is what we use today, in what we call the damning warrants. And this is one of our initiatives that runs out of the Department of Public Safety, as well as the Attorney General's office. And it does exactly what it says. It actually we put a dam in the money at the Western Union stage between the large criminal organization, which is what we refer to as the head of the snake, and it dams the money to the coyote or the person on this side of the border that's here to pick up the money in order to smuggle back the human beings and or the narcotics. There's, to give you an idea, there's a handout in the blue folder I handed to you. It's right after the big packet. You'll see it. It was an article printed in the paper a few months ago, and it really caught my eye because it really demonstrates how much of a hub that we are, and it's something that every city of Mesa, every city should look at. And it demonstrates how much money the state of Arizona wire transfers out at a Western Union to what Washington, D.C. considers the 27 top states where immigrants settle. So you look at where these immigrants are settling, and then they're wiring money to Mexico to get their relatives smuggled back over. And if you can see the difference, the disparity is enormous. I mean, each side of what Arizona sends is in the 100,000s. And some of them are in just the thousands. And then you look at the side of where these states are sending money to Arizona, and it's all in the millions. And some of them are in 15 million, 17 million. I mean, it is incredible how much money flows through this state, and the lion's share of that money is going towards human smuggling. And that'll be told out of the Attorney General's office. Kip Holmes, there is the absolute guru in human smuggling and wire transfers. And he will tell you that in his experience, and he's been doing this for a long time, that the lion's share of this money is going for that, which makes us, and the state will tell you this and the feds will tell you this, the hub of human smuggling, and nobody wants that title. So we've got the damning warrants in place. They've been in place for a few years now. To date, we've recovered about over $23 million, and it's resulted in over 240 felony arrests, which, you know, has been extremely successful. That money goes directly back into law enforcement on this side. So we consider that extremely successful. The second one is vehicle theft. Auto theft is a huge problem in the state. People are stealing cars in this part of town and driving them to the border. So we created, the Department of Public Safety created what we call the Southern Arizona Vehicle Theft Task Force. It's basically a roving task force. It roves from border town to border town. It's consisted of about 12 officers. And their main goal is to look for stolen vehicles that are traveling basically from this part of the state into and towards the border. They've been extremely successful. They've recovered over 200 stolen vehicles over the past year. An exciting part of that, which I believe MESA is a part of, is that we just implemented new technology, which is called LPRs. They're license plate readers. I believe MESA did a pilot project on license plate readers as well. And they've turned out to be extremely successful. We've only had them in these cars. We have 5 up right now. Our long-term goal is to obviously expand them into every car. They've been extremely successful. I mean, the technology, as you guys are well aware, I'm sure you've maybe presented with this information beforehand, but just an example is in a regular 8-hour officer shift, an officer can input 40 license plates. These license plate readers can input 1,500 license plates in a regular 8-hour officer shift. So the car just drives by, it instantly runs it through the database, and then, bam, you get a hit on a stolen vehicle, you can get them right there. That's caught 34 vehicles in the past 2 months. You can only tell, we caught 200 in a year. You can only see where this number's going. So, this is something that MESA should also look at in implementing. I know you guys had it as a pilot program. I don't know if you've actually implemented it in your officer vehicles, but it's something to look at for sure. The third thing was gang-related crime and just community crime in the border areas. The governor was able to secure, with the help of the legislature this year, refunding for GITM, which is the Gang Intelligence and Immigration Enforcement Teams. These were an existing program. Funding kind of failed over the last few years out of the legislature, but was reinstated this year and has been a true success. We've not only been able to expand GITM in counties that don't have, that had existing ones, we've now expanded them. But as of recent, as of last month, we put an entirely new squad in Cochise County down in Douglas, which is great, which goes directly towards gang-related and immigration-related crime. The cities can play a part in this because GITM is actually a collaborative effort. These are efforts not only with the Department of Public Safety, but with state and local, or with sheriff's office and local PD's office, can also join the GITM squads, and we would love to have them join. When the legislative passed this last session, there was a little problem with it. When it passed, there was actually a caveat in there that said local law had to enter into MOUs with the federal government. This is 287G training. I don't know how familiar you are with that. It's basically the federal law that allows local law to enforce federal immigration. The legislature has now realized what an impediment that is. The federal government is not as willing to enter into those agreements as we had once thought back in the beginning. So they have agreed to remove that stipulation in the legislation in January so that it's easier for local law to join these GITM forces and then be able to solely join these forces to go after gang and immigration-related activity in their own city. So we have that. And finally, the fourth thing was cross-training. And cross-training has two parts. One, DPS does a lot of cross-training with Mexico. And this is the last handout in your packet. It is kind of an overview of what DPS does with cross-training in Mexico. It's very active. We've intensified the program since 2003. We do a lot of cross-training. The sheet attached is a list of cross-trainings that we've done just in the past year with all of our Mexican counterparts. We work closely with the other side of the border, and they want to be trained as well in everything that we know. They also come across the border to what's called the PISA conference. I'm sure you guys might be aware of that. And they do some training of their own on from their side of the border. They've instituted a lot of the same technology, so it's good to get both sides. That's also something that the city should look at. That cross-training is open to everybody, and it's on a constant basis. And if officers here wanted to be cross-trained, we'd be more than happy to implement them in that program. Cross-training also goes to cross-training with the feds. And I'll tell you, a year ago, we were optimistic. We tried a cross-training program, cross-training 8 of our DPS officers. We wanted to do a pilot program that cross-trained 8 of our DPS officers with ICE and or Border Patrol. We wanted to make somewhat of a joint unit. We thought since I know Mesa may be experienced this problem. However, in other parts of Arizona, they are. And the problem was that ICE was understaffed and ICE was just not showing up. So we had a huge catch and release problem, and we just didn't know what to do. So we thought creating this joint enforcement team was ideal because you had the state there, you had the feds there, the whole process could be done in one fell swoop. And we thought that at least a pilot project was something that we should try. We had several meetings with the feds and ran into several amounts of red tape, as I'm sure you may have read in the papers. They were really, in the end, unwilling participants. They've tried this in a couple other states. It wasn't as successful as they wanted it to be. I think they're apprehensive. And there's also certain things to look at on the state side, because when you enter into those MOUs, your officer then becomes under the federal responsibility. And some state departments and some city departments don't really want that, because it's liability on them, it's liability on the feds. And so there's a lot of issues to look at. There's a lot of issues we ran into. And in the end, it just turned out it just didn't work out. But cross-training can happen at that level, and it did happen. We did enter into an MOU with the feds at our Department of Corrections. This turned out to be a very successful program. We had a problem with when you're an illegal alien that we're housing at our Department of Corrections, if you serve 50% of your time for certain nonviolent crimes, you're actually eligible for deportation. Unfortunately, there was no staff or resources on the federal side to come and actually fill out the large amount of paperwork that's necessary and to deport these guys. So basically, they agreed and signed an MOU to where we trained our DOC staff to fill out this deportation. They're allowed to fill it out. They're allowed to fill out the paperwork and transport them. So there it was successful. They were 287G trained, and they were allowed to enforce federal immigration law in that respect. So it is possible, and I know my time is coming to an end, but I just wanted to say I brought Lisa Behrens Morrison with me here today. She's the director of our Department of Liquor, and one of our most successful initiatives is our Fraudulent Identification Task Force, and she's going to speak about it just for about 5 minutes about what we do with fraudulent identifications in the state. Lisa.
Thank you. Good morning, Mayor, members of the council. I would be remiss if I jumped right into the Arizona Fraudulent Identification Task Force without thanking you for your city's cooperation with the Department of Liquor and the effort to enforce liquor laws. The City of Mesa Police Department has been wonderful, has been a great partner over the last 3.5 years that I've been at the department, and we look forward to more and greater joint enforcements. The Governor's Arizona Fraudulent Task Force was created approximately a year ago in July as part of the governor's Strong Border Secure Arizona project. The mission of the task force is to go after the major manufacturers and sellers of fraudulent identifications. As the head of the Department of Liquor, I was seeing a lot of fake IDs, and that brought conversations with the governor's office about the prevalence of IDs and how easy they are to make. Over the last year, it's become evident that fake IDs have long progressed from being used for underage drinking to now fraudulent immigration purposes. The document that you have in front of you, the multi-page colored document, is actually a PowerPoint presentation, so it does not have numbers on it, but I will hopefully direct you to keep flipping the pages quickly so that I can go through the presentation. The actual task force is comprised at this point of 12 officers. They're housed at the Arizona Counter Terrorism Information Center, or known as ACTIC. And we are a state, federal, and local law enforcement agency. We currently have representatives from the Department of Transportation, Department of Economic Security, Department of Corrections, ICE, Immigration, Customs and Enforcement, the Phoenix Police Department, Department of Juvenile Corrections, the U.S. Department of State, and the U.S. Border Patrol. These officers work in a covert capacity statewide, seeking out the major manufacturers and sellers of these fraudulent identifications. If you flip the next page, which would be the third page in your packet, what we were seeing, as I just discussed, how easy it was for an underage person to buy a fake ID. Cost $100. What we then did is sent in an undercover officer who told the manufacturer of these fraudulent IDs that he was a coyote and he was going to be smuggling illegal immigrants into the state. The price went up, $200. The next page, $400. But this time, it was for a fraudulent driver's license to be used by Middle Eastern nationals. The last operation that the governor's task force did was in the middle of September. It was titled Operation Document Fraud. What we found out in that operation was exactly how easy it was to purchase these documents. What we did is we had our undercover operatives use Middle Eastern photos, go to these manufacturers, and we took the names off the FBI's top 10 terrorist list. And we had four of those men that were on the terrorist list. We had immigration documents made for them, which means they could get on an airplane, they can open a bank account, they could do basically anything that you and I can do. It shows how serious the problem really is. So $400, you can buy a driver's license as a Middle Eastern person with any identity you want. The next page shows at the top a valid Social Security card. It shows what's on the back. What we're finding are these templates that are being used have a lot of mistakes in them. The mistakes are shown to you at the bottom of the page that are highlighted in yellow. The next document is just a photo of the normal scene where we find these documents being sold and manufactured. They're usually local storefronts. Some are made in apartments and houses, but the transactions are done on street corners. The next document, which is entitled Same Suspect, if you look at this Mexican ID, it's the same photo, but different identities. It's important to take note of why these people are making fake Mexican IDs as well as U.S. or Arizona IDs or any other state for that matter. It's because they can change their identity when they come across the border. Whether you're Middle Eastern, whether you're Mexican, you can change your identity, get a new ID, you lose your past by coming across the border and identifying and establishing yourself as someone else. The next document tells us that the average cost for what we call a three-pack, which can be made in less than an hour, is about $160. If you want a new identity, a three-pack is a Social Security card, a permanent resident card, and a driver's license. You can become whoever you want to be. That page also demonstrates some additional fraudulent identifications that we found in the course of a number of our search warrants, including fraudulent birth certificates and car titles. The next document shows a Sonoran driver's license. This is the newest Sonora driver's license. The old Sonora driver's license that you may be familiar with were yellow and green. They ceased using those a number of years ago because they found that those templates had been stolen and they needed one that could not be reproduced. Susie Barr was speaking about the cross-training going on with our Mexican counterparts. This is imperative. We met with our Sonoran counterparts, and what we were told was that the Sonoran driver's license was not reproducible, unequivocally not reproducible. We showed them what was being made here in the Phoenix, Mesa, Glendale area, and they were astounded how good the fake Mexican Sonoran driver's license really was. Almost impossible to detect the real one from the fake one. If you look on this one, same name on the Sonoran sheet, on the red driver's license, same personal information, different photographs. They're using the same template over and over again. The operational needs of the task force vary from day to day, but the bottom line is that we look forward to working with Mesa, and we have worked with Mesa. They've been great partners in this when we have conducted our large operations. We need UC officers to make purchases of these fake IDs. We utilize CIs, or confidential informants, with where to tell us where to purchase the documents. And we always rely on local law enforcement to execute our warrants. The last warrant, the last operation we did involved almost 20 search warrants one morning. So you can imagine the manpower that it takes to do one of those operations. Finally, the last sheet in your packet gives us the current stats of the Arizona Fraudulent Identification Task Force to date. And the most important thing to remember is this has been in operation for only a year. And this group has conducted over 92 search warrants. They have charged over 160 defendants. We have seized over 1,100 fraudulent identifications. That involves not only just fake identities, but real stolen identities. So it's a secondary problem that we're encountering. We look forward to continuing to work with Mesa and the other cities that have been so important in these efforts. Thank you for the opportunity to tell you about this task force and the successes over the past year.
I appreciate your presentation. I have a couple of questions the other council's members may also. In November 2005, the Arizona Department of Corrections entered into an agreement when the 287G program.
Right.
I think that's a three-week training program for correction or something, and 5 weeks if you want to do the full-blown program with them. That seems to have been successful. You've saved $3 or $4 million by getting early deportations and stuff. Why did that one work out and your other program did not? It seems like if one program would work with a same federal agency, but the other one did not. What was the difference in the programs?
I think the main difference was enforcement. I think the federal government was apprehensive in having local law enforcement here enforcing federal immigration crime actually on the streets.
They're doing it in Alabama.
Right. I know there's other states where they're doing it. I can't really answer. I mean, we had what you were saying. We were saying the same things. You're doing it in Alabama. You're doing it in Florida. You're doing it in L.A.
Right. Are you going to continue to pursue that, or is the governor with the new change?
With the new change in the ICE leadership, yes.
Okay.
I think we are going to pursue that. I think it's no secret that I think that was one of our major problems was right. The ICE leadership that was here in the past. I think, as you'll see in the packet I handed out to you, there's several letters written by Sheriff Joe as well as by the governor requesting new ICE leadership. We're happy that we have it. I think he's starting sometime this week or next. So we are going to re-pursue the fact of we're not looking to change our department into federal immigration officers.
Right.
That's not the idea. That was never the idea. And in fact, when the whole trespass issue came up, it was pretty much a consensus among all law enforcement in the state, or at least what I heard from letters that we received, that they didn't want to become federal immigration. They had their own job to do in the state. But as far as 8-man, 10-man squads, you know, being crossover squads, I think it's a great idea. And I would hope that maybe the feds would be more, you know, be more willing participants this time around. We'll see.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Councilmember Griswold.
Just a question on your border license recognition. Are they installing those at the borders now to watch cars going into Mexico and screen them?
You know, they have not been installed there, but that's part of our implementation plan, is to put them on this site and just have them run the plates as they're going through the ports.
Because it makes
right
sense
now,
with a long line sitting there. It takes a long time to get through there. You have plenty of time to run them and look at them. And while you're stuck in line with a stolen car, it makes you sweat a little more.
Yeah.
But we lose a heck of a lot of our cars. We used to have one of the highest rates of car theft in the United States here in the Southwest and in Mesa. Now we have the second. We put the bait cars in and some other things, but they're going, the majority of them, from what I'm being told, to Mexico.
Yep.
So we need to get this on the border soon and stop this.
Yep. And we couldn't agree more. We just got this technology. I mean, as far as multiple cameras, we just got them in May. So, and we already have money allocated to buy more. And I think we want to get, we want to put them down at the ports of entry in conjunction. I mean, we have to get in conjunction with the feds and Donna De La Torre, who runs the federal ports of entry. So it's a great idea. It's what we want to do. And it's a great opportunity to run their plates. I mean, it's just so simple. And these machines are just so simple to install. It's just a matter of funding.
The other thing you mentioned, the DOC, the Department of Corrections staff. Right now, if you're an illegal that's convicted of a crime, mm-hmm. you go to jail here.
Yeah.
When you get out and we don't have a MOU with the federal government, you just get kicked out in the streets here?
No, we were just they're allowed for early release. They're allowed to serve only half of their time before deportation, as long as it's a non-violent felony offense. And what was happening is, they were getting deported ultimately by the end of their sentence. But we didn't have an obligation under our law to keep them to the end of their sentence. And this was costing the states millions of dollars because it took them that long. They were that understaffed that it took them that long to fill out the paperwork. And we had staff at DOC that could do it, but they just didn't have the authority. So that's basically what that MOU change was, that now the staff at 50% of their time, our staff can fill out the paperwork and transport them down to the ICE, the local ICE office, or down to the border, however they want to do it, and then deport them. So that saved us millions of dollars in our department.
Does Sheriff Pio have that right now? Or has he gone through that? He doesn't have the right.
No. He, if you'll read in the letter, he asked ICE recently to deport. They did not pick up large amounts of illegal immigrants that needed to be deported. He wrote a letter talking about the ICE leadership as well as the ICE under, you know, the lack of resources here with ICE, and that he was going to drive them down there himself, which he did. So, no, at this stage, he doesn't have that authority. I mean, he could just drop them off at the Border Patrol down there, but he doesn't have the authority to enforce that immigration law. They do not have an MOU.
Thank you.
So if you were to enter into a memorandum of understanding and they agreed to do that, then there would be cross-training under the 287G program.
Exactly.
Which allows you to transport. It allows you to also access database to fill out the paperwork that you're talking about.
Yeah. To this point, I didn't include it in your packet, but I do have a copy of the MOU we did give the feds.
Okay.
This is the MOU we tried to work out on the eight-person squad. It talks about the legal authority, it talks about the functions that we wanted to do, which is basically, you know, our Department of Public Safety working the highways, they run into these large truckloads all the time. And if they were able to be cross-trained, interrogate, determine alienage, which is a huge issue, and then be able to go from there, that would be, you know, we wouldn't be wasting a lot of resources, we wouldn't be wasting a lot of time. And we wouldn't have to release them because DPS has to release them at this point if ICE doesn't show up because we don't have the authority.
And explain to me the relationship, because I'm very interested in this program and was back in 2000
but there was no training program. Now it's in place.
Yeah.
But would there be any advantage to a municipality doing it, or is it better set up on a county or a state level? Where do you get the most impact from?
Well, I think it just depends at the city level. I mean, I think it depends on the impact of how many, illegal immigrants you're seeing, how many problems you're seeing with catch and release, how many problems you're seeing with your law enforcement. You know, I mean, I don't know the situation here in Mesa. I've read a few articles on it, and it seems to me you guys may have a good ICE response, which is excellent. I see a couple of no's. Maybe the article I read was wrong, but if you don't, which not many people do, they're just understaffed. It's not really, I don't blame it on ICE here. I just blame it on the fact that they're underfunded. They don't have enough resources to respond to all the calls that local law enforcement gives them. So if that's a city problem, I think pilot projects like that of making squads of 8 officers is a good idea. I mean, I just see the benefits only because you have somebody there that can do it, and you don't have to rely on the feds that don't do it right now. And I know citizens of Mesa as well as the state are concerned about catch and release, because you're just actually releasing them just back into neighborhoods to do what nobody knows. So if you want a copy of this, it's a good, this was a template. We barely worked on it with them because they were pretty much a no at the get-go. So, but this was a template that we handed them that kind of goes through all the authority we wanted our officers to have. Another thing is money. It's huge, bill. If you wanted to make a department cross train, I mean, this cross training, it takes place in Virginia. I know they can do it here, but it is an 8-week training program, and that's 8 weeks of one officer off the street. So you got to think about those consequences as well. But
right, I think they're looking for a 2-year obligation too from that officer that they'll stay in the program, and there's some other.
Sure, and sure they've got some other things as well. And they're also looking for liability purposes. They'll talk to you about that as well, as far as who becomes responsible for that officer as soon as they start enforcing federal immigration laws.
Right.
Is it them or is it us? And that you work out with your own police department. Our State Department had a little bit of a problem with where do you draw the line and when are they enforcing state law and when are they enforcing federal law and who's liable. So those things are to work out, but I can pass these out for you, and it'll give you a great template of what to work with.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Vice Mayor, please.
Thank you, Mayor. I apologize. I have a cold. I had a question on the identification issue. Have you looked at the use of biometrics of some kind in order to alleviate some of these problems? I think it would probably need some national cooperation to really work, but has there been some conversation that's been occurring more on a national level that talks about using biometrics in identification?
Mayor, council member, we are generally aware of what's going on with biometrics. Unfortunately for us, this task force is solely aimed at this point in going after the major manufacturers and sellers of fake IDs. When I say unfortunately, while they've done a great job, we don't have a recommendation at this point how to fix the problem. And I'm not so sure there is a recommendation available with current technology. Where we've discussed the retinal scanners, we've discussed the actual biometrics, the 2-finger, the 3-finger, the 5-finger identifications. There are various technologies that are out there that have been discussed, but we have not had the time nor the opportunity to look into those at this point.
That's one of those things that I would hope that the state would engage in a broader dialogue there on that issue. I think it's very important. And back to the cross-training issue for just a moment.
Sure.
I'm just thinking that if there were enough of us who were interested in cross-training that we could get them to come here, that would be, to have these groups that could then help link into ICE, because we do have a problem. It hasn't been great. In terms of the catch and release, we had an incident a couple of years ago in my district where they arrested the gentleman, let me use the individual, driving the vehicle, and turned loose all of the people that he was smuggling in the vehicle into the neighborhoods in my district.
Sure, well, we don't have authority to keep
them. And the response was, well, we didn't have enough manpower to do anything with that, which was incredibly frustrating to us, incredibly frustrating to the residents of the area, and frankly, we don't understand it.
Yeah. And, I mean, you're preaching to the choir here. It's a problem for us. I've met with ICE several times, and, you know, it basically just comes down to a funding and a manpower issue from the top, not from here. You know, you can talk to these guys all day long, but they'll give you the same answer, is that in their Phoenix office, I think they had two or three guys. You know, they have two offices, their immigration enforcement office, and then they have their detention and removal office. And the detention and removal office was way understaffed. I mean, these are the people that you need. I mean, I guess when we started this, the pushback was they told us they weren't coming past Pinal County. Their job was on the border, and they weren't coming past Pinal County. But as everybody knows, you know, you have a line up there, but if the line's not strong enough at the border, they're obviously going to infiltrate through. And we have problems in Maricopa County. We have problems in, you know, all the way west, and we even have problems in north. So they got to look at the big picture, and it's happening to the entire state, and that's where we're continually in conversations with them and with, you know, Secretary Chertoff on a constant basis, just telling him that this is what's happening in our state, and this is what we need. So we're hopeful. We're hopeful with the new leadership here in ICE. And I think now that back then it was also a territory thing. You know, it wasn't, the feds weren't looking as good in the subject either, so they didn't want to make it look like they needed the state's assistance. I think now maybe a different picture, since they have brought a lot of resources to the state in the last year and just the last few months. So I think it might be a different picture, and I think they might be looking to partner with the state on more things. So we're hopeful. We remain optimistic.
Mike? Thanks for your presentation.
Sure.
It seems to me that law enforcement's largest problem is the criminal element of the aliens that are here. They're the ones that are running the drug trade. They're the ones that are smuggling. Mm-hmm. Humans are committing the burglaries, are doing all the violent crimes. It would make more sense to me to have a federal agent assigned to every detention facility so that when that alien is released, rather than us having to do it and be trained to do it, it'd be a lot cheaper in the long run for them to put their personnel within those facilities, whether it be DOC, whether it be county jails. So when they are released, they're sent back. And then an arrangement with the Mexican government to where they're detained there. That's the problem. The problem is I don't think we should be chasing maids and dishwashers and gardeners. We need to be chasing the criminal element. And then the federal government can then work out the problems in dealing with the whole rest of the population. Our emphasis should be on the criminal nature, and I don't see anybody really focusing on that. They're lumping everybody together, and that's the problem.
Right, and I agree with you. I think that if they were to offer that, we'd be gladly acceptors. They're not, they haven't, and I don't know if they will. I mean, I'd be more than happy to take that idea back and offer it up to them. As far as being in our facilities. The reason why I say we've tried and gone forward with this MOU as well as offering up our resources is because we don't get offers from them, so we're just trying to offer up whatever we can because we see the criminal element. We hear from it on a daily basis. I mean, not only in the cities here, but, I mean, you can only imagine the border towns and the residents there. I mean, they're infiltrated every day with people illegally crossing over that border and then running through their yards, and you know, those towns are horrified. So, I mean, this is what we can do at the state level is only provide whatever resources we have as far as our law enforcement and continually just ask the feds for their assistance. And we would love it if they would do that.
It just seems to be a waste of our time to have to send officers to Virginia to be trained to do something we're not supposed to be doing. Whether we would exercise the political will as every community, every state agency, every county agency to demand. I mean, demand got the National Guard on the border.
Yeah.
Demand got 1,500, 2,500 new Border Patrol agents. demand from the populace will get it done. It's just that we've got too big of a problem. We're trying to eat the elephant with one bite. You've got to start with the criminal element, in my opinion.
Right.
And I know I'm preaching to the choir. I'm just trying to make a point that it doesn't make sense for us to have to do it. We've got enough to do dealing with the criminal problems that this criminal population have brought us.
Right, and we have enough to deal with our own criminal problems here in the state. I mean, apart and aside from federal immigration or immigration-related crimes. I mean, there's enough crime here. But I couldn't agree with you more, and we will continually try. You know, when we tried to do this, the only thing that they would actually agree to, which we turned down for the reason you'll see in a minute, is that the only thing they were willing to let us do was transport our officers off the street transporting, illegal immigrants was a waste of our time. I mean, there are other people that can do transportation from Maricopa County to the border, or transportation from wherever you pick them up to the ICE office in Phoenix. I mean, that's the only thing they were willing to work with us on, and we turned it down solely because that's a waste of our officers.
Thank you.
Okay. Tom, and then Scott.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to clarify a couple of things. The people that are in the Department of Corrections are there for violation of state law.
That's correct.
If they're in the country illegally and that's their only crime, they don't get housed in our state facility. They get housed in the federal facility.
That's correct.
Okay. So when we're talking about releasing these people that are going to be deported,
yes.
The MOU, and I think this is the key between what we have with DOC and what they try to do with DPS, is that essentially we had a captive audience with the DOC people, and all we were doing was the paperwork to expedite their release.
That's correct.
Okay, because if we didn't do that, immigration or the federal government would deport them at the end of their sentence, but what we were trying to do was to save the second half of their sentence where we were still housing them and having to pay for that.
Exactly.
Okay, so I think it's a lot easier to train people to do process and paperwork and get a deportation earlier than it is to decide how you selectively enforce and how many officers and how you do the DOC people aren't really enforcing federal immigration law.
No, they're not.
They're assisting in the process.
Paperwork.
Right. They're assisting.
They don't have the authority to do, but the MOU gave them the authority.
The authority to process paperwork that expedited their deportation.
But the underlying their thing, just to remember, is that it is totally different, and which is why we ran into problems on one side and not problems on the other. But the underlying thing is that they did admit the weakness, and I think that's the problem on both ends, is
right.
That admitting the weakness, and they did admit it there, that there was a weakness and that they did something about it.
And I want to go to the identification, and I start with what Mike said. I agree with him that to the extent that we can focus our resources, we need to focus it on the people that come across here to commit crimes as opposed to the people who respond to the economic opportunities and the other things that are here, because that motivation is going to continue as long as there are corrupt and incompetent and feeble economies in the South and the allure of the American economic and personal freedom dream north. I mean, it doesn't matter how big we build the fences, that draw, that magnetism is still going to be there. So I think Mike is right on when we say we have to focus on the criminal element, which leads me to the question on the Operation Fake ID. Of the 1,150 seized fraudulent documents, how many of those were the poor college sophomore trying to get into a bar early versus the kinds of things that you've described in your packet?
It's a great question, but in this case, all of the documents that were seized were immigration related.
Okay, good.
These are manufacturers that are making these documents solely for immigration purposes. Now, I can tell you that if you want an exercise just to shock the senses, go on to any search engine on your computer, put in manufacturer fake IDs, and you will find many opportunities to buy an underage ID for about $100.
Well, that was going to be my point. Is again, I would hope that this operation, and I wasn't going to be critical, I was going to try to make a suggestion, but you've already grasped it, which is focus on those kinds of activities, the immigration-related ones, and lead the sweeps of the 20-year-old sophomores trying to get into a bar at ASU to the other portion. I'm not saying it's not important, but the other part of your liquor control operation. So I'm glad to hear that you're focused in the right direction.
Thank you. These manufacturers are being charged with major crimes. These are not misdemeanors. These are felonies. These are Class 2 fraud schemes. These are Class 3 theft. There are stolen identity charges, aggravated stolen identity charges being filed. So we're just in the beginning stages of the prosecution, but we're looking forward to lengthy prison terms, not just jail.
Okay, Scott.
Thank you, Mayor. Susie, yes. You said a couple of things that struck a chord with me, and then the Vice Mayor also said a few things. It has to do with catch and release. You mentioned that you have prisoners in the jails and or in prison, and if the feds don't come get them, we don't have the authority to hold them. The Vice Mayor said in her own district, they pull over a car, they arrest the driver, there's illegals or what suspect to be illegals in the vehicle, they're released into the neighborhood. Why are we releasing them? Why is it that the local government, or in this case the state government, does not have the authority to hold somebody suspected of having crossed the border? What's the legal precedent here?
Well, first of all, being in this state illegally is a federal crime, not a state crime. So that's responsible for the governor signed into law a human smuggling law, which makes the smuggler now guilty of a state crime, which is now somebody that we can actually take into our own prisons. I think it's still up for interpretation, and I know there's some with our Maricopa County attorney. I think there's some challenge of that as to whether the actual people in the vehicle, the smugglees, are part of that, are part of that operation. But I don't think that is yet to be decided. But as far as right now, they're not committing an actual state crime. They're committing a federal crime of being here illegally.
Bank robbery is a federal crime. We can hold bank robbers. That was a question posed to me in an email. So that's a federal crime, right? Kidnapping's a federal crime, but we can hold those folks. So what's the difference between illegal immigration and bank robbery, all those other crimes?
Yeah, and I don't have a clear answer to that question. I can research it and look it for you, and maybe he can
Well, I'll ask our city attorney, what's the difference between that crime, those crimes that I noticed that are federal crimes, and this? This is a federal crime, so where's the legal difference?
Councilmember Summers, it goes down to what is the crime. Being present in the United States illegally is only a civil violation. It is not a criminal violation. The only criminal violation is illegally crossing the border. That is a misdemeanor. If they are found guilty of illegally crossing the border as a misdemeanor, they are deported. And then if they are found a second time illegally entering the United States, that is a felony. But simply being here...
Entering being... Putting
crossing
their foot
the
over the border.
We would have to have
presence.
Probable cause to believe that they illegally crossed the border. Illegally being present in the city of Mesa is not probable cause that they illegally crossed the border. And the reason for that is many people come to the United States under a legal visa or under a student status, and they may extend their stay here, and they don't leave when the visa expires. That would be considered illegal presence, and that is a civil violation, and the city has no authority, or anyone other than the federal government, they have no authority to enforce illegal presence.
So it's civil versus criminal.
That's correct, Council Member.
Bank robbery is criminal. We can hold them for that.
Correct.
This is civil.
And it is a very fine line when we detain someone for questioning. At what point do we have probable cause that they illegally entered the United States versus, okay, they do not have documentation on why they are present, but that is a civil violation that we have no authority to enforce. Whether, just in briefly looking at the MOU that we attempted to enter into with ICE, it appears as though DPS was seeking the authority to arrest without warrant for civil and criminal immigration violations. So under this model, that may be a mechanism for the city to enforce civil violations of the immigration law. But apparently ICE was not willing, at least at that point, to accept that term.
Exactly.
Well, that was going to be my follow-up question. Could a memorandum of understanding allow us to enforce the civil portion of this? And apparently we could. We don't have to go back for a federal change of law in order for us to enforce this. It would be a memorandum of understanding, and that would depend on the willingness of ICE to allow officers to do that.
And the willingness of the council to engage in the MOU under those terms.
Okay. How long does it take to process the paperwork for deportation in the prisons? You said it was a pile of paperwork. How long?
You mean the timeline? The timeline now, I'm not sure exactly how long it takes as far as by time, but it's a lot. I know it is a pile of paperwork to not only fill out their release paper, but also their deportation papers. I'd have to get that information from our director of the Department of Corrections. I'm not sure exactly.
Would you do that for me?
I would.
I'd be interested to know, because how long could we hold somebody for a civil violation?
24 hours. If we arrest someone, whether it's actually criminal or civil, if they are arrested for purposes of immigration, we have to contact ICE, and ICE would have to pick them up within 24 hours, is my understanding. There's a case law, Gonzalez versus City of Peoria, that says even if local law enforcement has the authority to take action, they can only detain for up to 24 hours, actually a maximum of 24 hours.
Okay. Tom, that's all.
Just a little further clarification, Scott. The deportation process can vary in great length depending upon how anxious the person who is being deported is willing to get that process done, because he has all sorts of due process rights that the hurdles have to be jumped through. So they can stretch out. They can probably be done in 3 weeks to a month, and sometimes they can stretch out for a year or more. And on your federal crime versus state crime, there is a state kidnapping statute. There is a state armed robbery statute. There is a state theft statute. So I think Mike probably backed me up on this. We probably arrest on the state charges. They may ultimately get charged federally, but we're, in my experience, police officers in the state arrest for state crimes. It may have been a bank that gets robbed, but if they're the ones who make the stop, they make the arrest on the basis of armed robbery or theft, not a violation of the federal statute.
Claudia.
Let me go back a second and ask a question on the earlier thing. I was not, and let me clarify, it wasn't the Mesa Police Department who made that stop on the 202 and did the release. That it was ICE saying, you know, we're going to take this person. We don't have the ability to take everybody else. My question, and this was the reason I was interested in the cross-training notion, was because, and maybe we already have the authority, and that really goes to my question. Right now, if ICE is saying, well, we don't have the manpower to do this, can they turn to the Mesa Police Department and say, come and assist us in this case? We need help because there are 20 people and I don't have anybody else to call as backup, and so I'm calling you as backup. And that was what was in my head as I was thinking about your MOU. Do you have to have an MOU to do that?
You do. In my opinion, you do, because you cross a fine line between state law and federal law there, and you don't want to, there's, you know, you're headed for a lawsuit if you don't have an MOU and one of the officers engages in trying to determine alienage, because, you know, you got to determine alienage at the site to be able to then move on. I mean, and the feds are trained to do that. And this is a huge thing. We heard about it for months when we were trying to get into this MOU. And it's the majority pretty much of their training, because if you determine the wrong alienage, you know, and you just make assumptions, then you may have some problems at that. So I would say you would have to get an MOU. I don't think they can assist in much, because most of it, when you hit a truckload, is most of it's going to be federally related, minus the person that's driving, which would be charged with a state crime of community.
Okay.
Thank you.
Let's take one more question on this, then move on. Kyle?
Going back to what Scott asked just a little while ago in regards to the difference between what is civil and what is criminal and what we can hold for, and the question was, coming across the border, you have people who come across on a student visa or a work visa, and they overstay that, and so they came into the country legally, but yet we're not allowed to ask how they came into the country. We're restricted from that is our problem. I mean, if they came in and they couldn't produce that they had a visa, and they couldn't show it to you, so you don't know how they came in the country, we're not allowed to pursue that at all.
Well, the difficulty comes in on a number of different avenues. Maybe we ask and we have no response. We don't have a mechanism for investigating. Second, there's could be a language barrier. So the words they use, does that give us probable cause to believe they crossed the border illegally? And as Ms. Barr was saying, that is a very litigious area, and because it is federal law and we do not have authority to investigate or enforce that, we have not gone down that path. Now, the one case, Gonzalez versus City of Phoenix, said there is some room there if the city has probable cause to believe they illegally crossed the border. The question is, how do you get to the point that you have probable cause, which allows you to act?
And so you can't go on the same premise of, say, for a traffic stop, you need to produce a license and your registration and insurance. You can't pursue anything in a similar fashion because we don't have the authority to, or at least the way it's set up now.
If they fail to produce, I'm sorry, Councilmember Jones, if they fail to produce the identification or proof of insurance, those are state requirements.
Right.
We can act on those requirements. That does not give us the authority to jump to the enforcing the federal immigration laws.
Yeah. Well, it all comes down to the way we're tied in things because of the way laws are set up, the way enforcement's set up. Even though you may have real strong reason to believe, unless you could really comfortably show in a court of law that you had reasonable suspicion,
probable cause.
Then there's really nothing you can do, or you'll spend all your time in court.
Thank you very much. It's been a good discussion.
Yeah, thank you very much for having us. Right. We appreciate it.
Right, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, item number two is to hear a presentation, discuss, and provide possible direction on illegal immigration reform issues. This was actually an item that I wanted put on the agenda for discussion by the council. Some of you may remember in January of 2001, I raised the issue of cross-training Mesa police officers with then INS capabilities. That was met with some lively discussion in the community. Although there was enabling legislation passed in 1996, I soon found out that there was no cross-training program that existed at that time. So I gave up that effort. There is now a cross-training program that we've heard about here this morning, the 287G program, which does allow cross-training if the ICE will enter into those agreements, and they've done that in several different states. Started out in 2002 with Florida Department of Law Enforcement. That became the first to enter into a cross-training, and it's also now in the jails of Arizona, we've heard here today. It's also in Alabama, North Carolina, and I believe also in California have signed up for some cross-training. That was kind of what some of the council members were asking about. How do you ask those questions in a civil stop and not get into trouble with the federal laws? And the one way that seems to be an avenue for that is the 287G program. So I was a supporter of doing whatever it was necessary to stem a tide of illegal immigration into the United States. When I took the oath of office, I took an oath of office to protect local, state, and federal laws and the Constitution of the United States. I didn't say that some of them that are on federal law I don't deal with, because if there's an issue out there, I want to figure out what tools we have. And if the federal government is understaffed or not capable of doing it, and they're asking now or have the ability to cross-train, I'd like to revisit that idea. So that was part of what I hope gets discussed this morning. I certainly have several additional questions and would like to eventually see if there are four council members present that would like to pursue the idea of looking at draft MOUs, talking to our police department, talking to the county jail facilities in the state to see if we don't do it, who we can collaborate with to get those type of questions asked on different civil matters and still not run afoul of the law and be tied up in lawsuits for the rest of our lives. So that was why the issue, one of the major reasons for putting the issue on. There may be some other council members that want to talk about the day labor centers. That was a topic that came up before. We've had anti-loitering, more code enforcement. There are probably a multitude of issues, but mine centered primarily around the 287G program. So why don't you go ahead and with your presentation, and we'll get back into those questions later.
Thank you, Mayor. Mayor and Council, here I have John Pompey, the city prosecutor, Pete Thompson, the police advisor, and Jim Hewling. We have worked together over the last 2 months to bring forward a comprehensive report as requested by Council, stating generally what the federal, state, and local governments have done either in the past or are attempting to do now to deal with immigration reform issues. And we've passed out the report for Council. Included in it is a summary of the legal analysis, both what the state and federal government have done, some examples of what we have seen across the country in terms of local ordinances, as well as issues dealing with the MOU. I don't have a formal presentation since this was a request for Council to present a report. We presented it to you a couple days ago, and we are certainly willing to answer any questions that you may have. Or certainly if you would like us to summarize any part of the report, we'd be happy to do that as well.
Okay. I think you probably get to the heart of the matter when we talk about different issues and possibilities to bring forward as a council. And I appreciate the information and some of the sightings on different areas of the country that have tried different approaches. I think there was just one passed last night over in Escondido on the housing that they actually followed the one, was it Hazleton, Pennsylvania code that's also been adopted by several cities. I know there's some legal challenges to that. I'm trying to avoid the legal challenges that come with a municipality enforcing INS rules or immigration rules. The only way I've found that you can shield yourself from some of that exposure and liability of crossing the line from a federal versus a local is the 287G program. Can you elaborate a little bit more on your research into that and the some of the towns that have adopted, one of those, I know there's, in Alabama, it's the state troopers, and
yes,
Charlotte, Mayor. They have the jail facility, and I've had some phone calls with some of the people that are actually doing those operations, and I've been fairly impressed with the information I get back. The Alabama state troopers the other day were reporting that they were calling into the national database and getting information back in 3 to 4 minutes on stops. So I was very impressed with the timeliness of their response once they have their PIN number and they've gone through the training, and they also the database that they have access to was fairly impressive. So if you can, it sounds like if you can get an MOU through, that there's some real benefits to it. I've just scratched the surface of what's out there.
And, Mayor, I think there is a lot out there, and if Council gives us direction to go really dig down, we would certainly be willing to do that. I can tell you, I think I'd break this up into 2 points. I can tell you generally what I know about the law and the MOU, and then I think Pete has some information about what other states or counties have actually done with regard to the MOU. The MOU does give us specific legal authority to enforce federal immigration law to the extent ICE agrees to the terms of the MOU. So there's where we kind of have some limitation. What are we willing to offer ICE in terms of what we're willing to do, and what is ICE willing to delegate to us? As we talked about a few moments ago with the governor's office, a number of them have dealt with just the Department of Corrections or jail facilities where the local entities are filling out the paperwork and assisting with the deportation process. They're not actually out there on the street enforcing federal immigration law. As the mayor mentioned, in terms of the liability protection that the MOU offers, the MOUs that I've seen typically do have some language stating that they will indemnify the officers for acts done in furtherance of the MOU. So we get into debating, okay, when the officer is typically out on patrol, and I guess this is one thing we would have to clarify with ICE, but if we entered into an MOU where it's the officer out on the street that is cross-trained and that is both performing duties as a City of Mesa officer as well as enforcing federal immigration law, the question will become, at the time that the act that we're now being sued for, was he acting as an ICE officer or was he acting as a local City of Mesa police officer? I don't know if they've had any experience with that in Alabama, but that would be the one issue. I'm sorry?
Actually, I've asked that question, and there have been no cases in Alabama for the 80-some officers that they have, but they all only do it under a probable cause thing, so there's some other citation that they pull over for. They're not out there profiling or doing any of the rest of the things that have been negatives in the past, but there are no legal pending matters for dispute resolution is what the information I received. Okay.
What they specifically exclude is coverage for intentional acts by the officer. Right. But there is a level of indemnification that would be provided to the city and the officers through the MOU. With regard to the specific items with some of the cities and entities that have entered into the MOUs, I'd turn it over to Pete.
Thank you, Mayor, Council. Just to clarify a few points the discussion's been ongoing over the last few days, and there's been kind of a difficulty in the timeline to get some of the information due to the late nature of phone calls back and forth. I'm sorry. Thank you. Let me clarify, with regard to the access to the database, I was able to find out that Mesa does have access to the database. However, it is a subset of NCIC. And I verified with a high-level official in ICE that will be affiliated with law enforcement in this area that, in fact, that is the case, that we're supposed to have access to it without an MOU already being in place. But we have to configure according to our ISD people, I learned this morning that we would have to configure our car-mounted computers to be able to access it in the field. So it is currently available to us, but we don't have the configuration set up, is my understanding. On the second part, as far as the MOUs, I think you're absolutely correct. I think there's two general bents in this. There's an MOU with the state of Florida and the state of Alabama, which are under this 287G, which authorizes the memorandum of understanding to be executed between the Department of Homeland Security and state and local law enforcement. It's directed at counterterrorism purposes, and much of the efforts are in Alabama and Florida are related to that. Florida has distributed its trained state troopers at 5 different counterterrorist units around the state, and they've had some successes in terms of identifying people who are here fraudulently. Alabama as well has 58 troopers that are trained, and unlike any other MOU, Alabama is out in the field and they are enforcing it those 58 troopers. Here's why I spoke to their legal counsel. I don't know if he's my counterpart, but he's in the same type of situation where he gives legal advice to them this morning. He indicates, much like what the mayor said, what they will do is their first priority is they will enforce state law. If they see a traffic violation, they'll pull over. Most of the arrests, he tells me, that they make under this that have application to 287G are actually arrests for state law. What they do in connection with the 287G is that they will process two pieces of paper once they've identified the individual in their database as being an individual who is in violation of immigration law. While the person's incarcerated, the paperwork goes to the feds, and the feds, the ICE people will come and deal with the individual while they are incarcerated for the other state law action. I'm not sure whether, I know that ICE can place immigration holds, and I'm not sure what happens to the jail bill after you've already been arraigned on the state law charge, and yet there's an immigration hold, and who pays for that? But that's the majority of interaction. The second thing he told me is if they've got a routine traffic stop, the example he gave me would be like a taillight out, which he says is a violation of law in Alabama. You pull them over. If you run them in the database and it's just a misdemeanor, that's a cite and release because ICE is not going to come out and get them, and they're not going to send a state trooper all the way back into Birmingham or wherever with a prisoner on that type of violation. So...
Did they also mention the officers that they had at their motor vehicle for licensing?
He didn't, but I have read about that. He did tell me this. He said that by far and away what the training has focused on for them has been identification of fraudulent documents. Right. So for them, that's been one of the things that they focused on, where if somebody, they stop somebody and the individual shows them identification, they're trained in this and are comfortable identifying that, and that's a state law violation, providing false information to a police officer, as well as the any other federal laws would be violated. To the extent of what he... That was basically the extent of what he told me they were doing in the field. I've read their MOU, and I defer to him with how they do it and what they do. But I know that the MOU says, and all the MOUs require, that any cross-trained officer act directly under the supervision of ICE. So how you do that out in the field with troopers or patrol officers or somebody who's out there on their own, I would be a little bit leery of exceeding the scope or being outside of that MOU. So those two are unique, Florida and Alabama. The rest of the MOUs all seem to be geared towards paperwork being completed so that people who are in Department of Corrections facilities or who are otherwise incarcerated may be processed for deportation. Interestingly enough, transportation and deportation are two different things. I've heard that talked about here this morning. Deportation is one of the authorities that cannot be delegated in an MOU. So no matter who it is, you can't delegate that authority. Transportation, you may be able to do that under the MOU. I'm not sure what other questions you may have with regard to how the MOUs are set up and how they would work, but I just wanted to make those points in terms of general overview.
Clarify something. I think, Pete, you just, as far as you know, and Mayor, we don't normally get to ask you questions, but you're the one that has talked to the people in Alabama, so I'd like you to tell us if this is different than what you have heard, is that the troopers in Alabama are not arresting or detaining people for violations of federal immigration law. Is that what you've learned?
No, that I'm sorry if I misspoke. If they run somebody and it comes back as a felon, if there's a felony hit for prior deportation, okay, that individual they would likely incarcerate.
Okay, so they are doing that.
Right. He also told me with regard to discretion, he says if I see a DUI on one side of the road and I've got somebody stopped and I've already run him and it's a taillight out with an illegal entry into the country, he says I'm dropping that stop and I'm going after the DUI.
Right.
So in prioritization.
Is Alabama participating or are they authorized in detaining people for violations of illegal presence as opposed to illegal entry?
Yes.
All right, so they're actually If they determine that somebody is in the country without proper documentation, they are taking them into custody?
If it's a felony.
Illegal presence is not a felony.
Correct. They could, but they're not.
Okay, so they're not.
And Councilmember Rawls, if I might add, looking at the Alabama MOU, they actually have the exact language that DPS requested but was unable to get. So it does say arrest without warrant for civil and criminal immigration violations and must notify ICE of any arrest within 24 hours. So apparently they have that authority, but they may not be implementing that portion.
Okay. And there, that's consistent with what you've learned?
Yeah. Did you talk to Heron Lowe, Assistant Attorney General?
Yes, Mayor.
So did I. So hopefully we got the same information.
That's what I was trying to confirm is that... Okay. Have they indicated, and I guess my question is, you're not clear how when they make the stop for the illegal taillight and they determine through this database that the person is a undocumented alien of some nature, whether civil or criminal, but probably criminal, and they decide to detain the person on that basis, where is the supervision provided by the ICE officer when they switch from investigating a taillight out to a reentry felony?
Best I can tell from reading the MOUs, either Birmingham, Mobile, or Montgomery.
Do they have to contact the ICE officer before they make the arrest and say, I'm now acting as an ICE officer or as a delegee of a...
I believe they don't. Whether they're supposed to or how it's set up, I don't know. But I got the distinct impression that they don't.
And how long has Alabama been doing this?
I'd have to research and find out exactly what the date was of the MOU. I can get that for you.
August 28th, 2003 is when the MOU was signed.
Okay. And Councilmember Rawls, the MOU says that they have to notify ICE of any arrest within 24 hours.
Right.
But in terms of your question, how, you know, practically or functionally, how do they do that? I think that's the question we would actually have to talk to ICE about and get that level of detail. What does supervision by ICE mean to ensure that we know what does the indemnification clause that they're giving us, what does that mean, and what type of protection are we being provided?
Go ahead, Pete.
I've got a concern from the legal perspective of how you do that. I know that in Arizona, once you've finished a cite and release, technically you're done, you're through, and the person is free to go. At that point, do you start making inquiries and what is your basis for then detaining the individual? You have to articulate some kind of basis for it. Even though you're authorized to enforce the law, you still have to abide by the Constitution. And I think that there's some difficulty in there, in my mind, with regard to how they actually arrive at that. That's why I was not surprised to learn that the majority of what Alabama is doing is bootstrapped after a state law violation, that they're also doing paperwork if they run in their computer and get the information.
Okay, now I'm back to where the source of my confusion. What I'm trying to figure out is if they do the taillight, which is not an arrest situation, and they discover that the person is in the country illegally, do they arrest them for that, or do they only do paperwork if they arrest them on a state charge?
Mayor, Councilmember Rawls, I was told that they cite and release on the taillight.
And not hold the person for a illegal immigration charge.
That's my understanding.
Unless there's a hit for a prior injury.
No, even if. That's what I'm trying to clarify.
If they come back and they have indication that they're in the country illegally now and they have a prior deportation, I think that they would arrest them there because that is a felony.
Okay, so now you're...
I think in Alabama, the information I have there, 732 sworn officers and 58% are ICE trained, so it's 8% of their force in Alabama, too. So it's a substantial number, but it's the unusual circumstance.
The number I was given, Mayor, was like 58, but I don't know what the percentage is.
58 ICE officers, 8% of, or whatever it is. There's 732 total officers. I'm just trying to give you a range of how many they've done.
And Mayor and Council, if I could just make sure we understand, that's the way Alabama's operating under the MOU system. There is the case that Gonzalez versus City of Peoria, that if we already have probable cause to believe that the person has committed an illegal crossing of the border, for example, if we run the NCIC, if we have the IT technology in the police vehicles and we run the check against the ICE database and we learn that the individual that we have stopped has illegally crossed the border already, we can actually take action at that point and call ICE and, you know, and detain for up to 24 hours, because at that point we would have probable cause to believe that they had illegally crossed the border. So even without the MOU, there is some action that we can take.
But I think with the MOU, they can detain for longer than 24 hours because they now have them up on charges for entry multiple times. So I think you then switch from a municipal to a federal.
They can
do the detainer, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Mayor. We would have to notify ICE within 24 hours, and I guess practically speaking, they would have to give us direction, but I don't know if Pete knows the answer to that.
Mayor, my understanding is they don't prosecute them. They would still be doing nothing more than arresting and turning them over to ICE, and ICE would be doing all the paperwork, the selective decision on prosecution.
Mayor, actually, this is it's a practice, for instance, in the city of L.A. has been done for many years. When you're running NCIC 1, you make a legal stop for whatever reason. It could be a traffic violation or some other reasonable suspicion event. You run the individual. If the individual comes up with an NCIC 1, which is basically an order from a magistrate or a court, whether it's immigration or any other thing, it's going to pop in the screen. In this case, if there's a 1 for illegal reentry, the officer sees that illegal reentry. The officer is being directed to take action upon that order. The individual gets arrested. Actually, the law enforcement center in Virginia is being notified immediately, electronically, that someone has made contact with this individual. Actually, this happens pretty seamless. ICE, in turn, in the case of L.A., would send a teletype or would call the jail and say, we want to hold this individual. If they do not notify us within 24 hours, we would call them and say, do you want to pick up this person? If they don't, you release. If they say, we want to pick him up, you hold him up to another 48 hours. There is no need for any special training for this. All that it has to occur is that you have to have the technological capability. So when the officer runs an NCIC warrant, the subset that has to deal with illegal reentry will come into the system. The officer doesn't need any additional training. The officer is being directed, here's a warrant for this individual. They take him into the jail. It gets reviewed by a supervisor. They get booked. And then ICE has to notify that they want to pick up the individual. If they do not notify, we give them a call. Say, we have this felon here. We have this individual that you indicated that you're looking for. And then if they do not pick up within 48 hours thereafter, you release. You have to release. There's no need for a special training for that. It's a very straightforward booking. It's like any other warrant. It's like if Phoenix PD has a warrant or, you know, for a suspect that we stop on the traffic stop.
Where the training comes in, then, is the interrogation or asking the arrestee country of origin, some of the rest. That is not a local police matter. That's only for either cross-trained or INS officials, well, ICE officials.
Well, actually, because
so you can, if they're in their computer, you can go through and book them for up to 24 hours, but you can't ask them any of the immigration-related issues.
That's correct. You're acting on the warrant or the warrant.
But you could, with the 287G, you could actually take it a step further.
I'm not really familiar with that.
I believe that's correct, Mayor.
Right. All right.
And I guess that's my question, because what you've described, Chief, is a lot different than what I think we may be talking about getting into. You're talking about, and I think this is what, Pete, you said Alabama's doing. If they punch this personal ID into the computer and it comes back that there's a reentry warrant or some kind of judge or somebody has said this person is a known, I mean, somebody has made a determination that this person has reentered the country illegally, arrest him. That doesn't take a lot of extra training.
No,
and from what I'm hearing from you, Pete, that's what Alabama's doing. Are Alabama officers also, when they have the confrontation with the suspect, engaging in the type of substantive interrogation to determine, totally absent any hit on the NCIC computer, that this person is a entered the country illegally? Are they arresting them for telling them that, yeah, I came across the border, and gee, by the way, this is my second time?
I can't answer that question because I didn't ask Harlan Lowe specifically that.
Because that's where the nuances and the difficulties and the liabilities and all those issues come into place. I mean, if a police officer doesn't arrest somebody when the NCIC computer says there's a warrant out for that person's arrest, that police officer ought to be fired. All right, but to ask that police officer to go further. Now, perhaps in the situation, that may be an overstatement, P. That when he sees a kidnapper going by or something, and you know, you might want to leave the illegal alien and go after that. But for the most part, most police officers are trained to follow court orders. If there's an arrest warrant, they'll arrest the person. What we're talking about is going beyond that and saying, develop your own probable cause, make your own determinations to whether or not a federal statute has been violated, and then act accordingly. That's what we don't know if anybody else is doing that.
Having not even asked the question, I can only say that based on that their legal counsel statement to me that unless it's a felony like has been indicated, that they would basically cite and release on the traffic violation, I can only assume that it wouldn't make any sense whatsoever to create the exposure to the officer and to his department to ask all of the questions that you're talking about asking, only to turn around and then cite and release, because the definitive information about or the threshold that you need will be told to you by the computer hit. It's either there or it's not there.
Yeah, that's easy.
Okay, other questions? Buddy.
Thank you, Mayor. Right now, Chief, I was under the impression that we were already doing this. If we picked somebody up and we brought them into the police station, that we were checking for those kinds of things right now. What I'm hearing is that we don't have that capability in the field right now. Is that correct?
As I understand it, our current systems are not given access to that subset of NCIC from a remote location in a police car in the field.
Okay, so one of the actions that this council could take is to give direction to modify things, sure, so that we have that ability.
Absolutely, and that would certainly provide the officers with a tool. You have to also understand that the reason why the want or warrant shows up in the NCIC system is because there has been already contact. These individuals were convicted of a crime that were reported. You know, if you cross the border for the first time, you really don't exist as far as any computer systems. There's no doubt, there's no basis there. But it would be very good for us if the council gave the direction so that we could have access to that information, because what we're talking about is we're dealing with hardcore criminal elements. These are people that have been convicted of felonies in this country before. They have been involved in narcotic sales. They have been involved in robberies. They have been in other activities. And it's an additional tool to deal with criminals that are committing serious crimes in our communities.
Well, I appreciate knowing this. I didn't know that we didn't have the access in the field. I had been aware of at least a few times when we had somebody in custody and checks were being done, so I assumed that we had that capability across the board.
I just became aware this morning and we did not have access in the field.
Okay.
I was not
aware
of that. I thought that was a done deal. It's just like many other things that I'm finding out. It's like, learn more about the city.
Well, to me, that would be an important thing for us to provide.
And that, by the way, requires no additional training or MOUs.
No, I agree with people on that. Let me ask another question. I'm trying to understand the scope or the size of what we're dealing with. Let's say that a man enters the country illegally and commits a crime, and therefore he cannot come back into the country without the permission of the Attorney General, is the way that the statute is written. And he comes back a second time, uses the same name, by the way. Let's say he's a really stupid person. All right. So he comes back, uses the same name. Is there something when he reenters through a port of entry, and the individual at the border doesn't catch it? Is the computer or anybody else going to catch that and have his name show up on an NCIC computer?
Not the illegal reentry. The way it's supposed to be is after the conviction and deportation takes place, that should be entered into the system in case that this person comes back and comes into
contact. If he uses the same name, so that it wouldn't show up necessarily as a warrant or an order from a judge, it would show up as this individual has previously been deported and ordered not to return.
It shows the thing illegal reentry. Interestingly enough, for instance, in the case of L.A., and L.A. will book somewhere between 30,000 and 40,000 people through this process every year. Most of the time, it's not in the field where you become aware of this problem. Most of the time, it's when you fingerprint them at the booking process, and then you get the fingerprint hit. Because generally, although they're stupid, they're not that stupid.
Right.
So they usually use another name. So it's usually the fingerprinting process, the one that will generate the hit. And when the hit does, by the way, this is all a seamless process. I mean, even though the jailer gets notified, the law enforcement center in Virginia is being notified immediately that this individual is there. They have 24 hours in which to put a hold.
Right.
Now, the policy in the city of L.A. was if you did not put a hold within 24 hours, we would physically call the center because we know how understaffed the center is. By the way, we got George here. Do you still want him? And they would actually do a hand search, and they say yes or no. If they say yes, we would hold him for another 48 hours. At the end of the 48 hours, if there was no one there to pick him up, then they get released. Generally, at that point, they were actually in county jail. So it's usually at the fingerprinting process where you pick up most of these individuals. Very few of them are actually picked up in the field.
Chief, in the field, let's assume that my hypothetical man here uses a second name when he comes in again. So when you run that name in the field, you don't get this person was previously deported and ordered not to reenter. Did the L.A. police officers at that point engage in any kind of substantive interrogation to ascertain the illegal entry status of that person?
If there was no hit and they just had, no, they wouldn't.
Okay, and we don't know what Alabama does.
Now, I have to say another thing, too. The technology is moving very, very rapidly. As a matter of fact, we're actually testing in the city of L.A., and I would love to test it here if the council finds the funding, where you actually can do wireless fingerprint identification in the field. If you have enough probable cause or reasonable suspicion to make a stop, and you develop additional cause to believe that you're being given false information, you could, if you have the technical capability, you could fingerprint somebody in the field wirelessly, and in a matter of seconds, quite frankly, find out whether they're telling you the truth or not. That technology is out there today, and it's not terribly expensive, and I would love to be able to test it if the council will be willing to give us the authority to search out and do a pilot program, because most of the time, regardless of your immigration status, bad guys, criminals, are going to lie to the police in the field.
Right.
And criminals generally don't like to tell us who they really are. And most of the time, we're going to have to be questioning people and looking through our training and experience to assess whether, in fact, it appears that they're lying to us or not. If we have the ability to fingerprint people wirelessly in the field and run them very quickly to see whether they have been in contact with law enforcement previously under another name, that would be a tremendous tool that would help us fight crime. And anything that you give us to fight crime, I want it, because it makes us more effective.
It worked on NCIS on Tuesday night. I noticed that. The only other question, again, I'm just trying to clarify the scope of the problem. Let's say somebody crosses the border, gets caught in the process, and is taken back and put across the border. That person is not subject to the felony reentry when they come back. Is that correct? Because don't they have to? There's a special. You actually have to go through the deportation process in order to have that reentry prohibition apply.
I'm not 100% familiar, so I don't want to give you an answer. I think I know what the answer is, but I don't want to state it on the record because I'm not really sure.
Okay. Does anybody else feel either more sure or less cautious?
He asks a group of lawyers.
Yeah. I'm not
sure of that answer either.
I think I know the answer as well, and I won't be any more risky than you guys are. I think the answer is no.
I think so. Okay. I had a page of information that was going to be the agenda for this meeting, and then we summarize it for local, state, and federal. But I have a couple of other issues that I'd like to just kind of ask if I could. One of them is one of the actions that we did is look at a day labor center to try to get people that were soliciting work on the street to a location that wasn't as disruptive to some of the businesses and not as visible. In your research on anti-solicitation or loitering, are there any other tools that we could examine today that would be useful to deal with some of the actual and perceived problems that that's creating?
Mayor, in terms of reviewing for anti-solicitation and anti-loitering laws, some of the other tools we've already begun. I know that we will come back to you at one point and talk about an operation that we did at, I believe, Gilbert and Broadway, where we created working with the business owners, we created a trespassing, not only for the individuals who were being solicited, but for the people who were soliciting them. So the drivers and the people they were picking up, if they were doing it on private property that these business owners owned, then we were citing both of those individuals. So we have gone that route. We have not found great information on being able to produce for you a constitutional anti-loitering law or loitering law. What we have seen is that the Supreme Court has been very deferential to people who want to, for lack of a better term, loiter on sidewalks as long as they're doing it for a legal purpose. So if I want to go out and stand on a public sidewalk and just stand there, the Supreme Court has basically said that's my constitutional right to do so.
Okay. You referenced in our documentation the Phoenix where you couldn't obstruct the pathway, or at least I think that's what we don't have that. Is how do they enforce that? Obviously, just say stand single file on the sidewalk instead of blocking it, I guess. But what was the reason behind that, and did it have any effect at all?
Well, Mayor, I don't know the experience I've had in Phoenix, but I can tell you what we believe the problem would be is how do you prove when someone is obstructing the sidewalk? In terms of the response time, in terms of the burden of proof, we have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt if they're going to be convicted of a misdemeanor. So it's just a practical problem. And as John said, the Supreme Court has looked at loitering laws a number of times. And unless you can prove that it is loitering with an intent to commit some type of unlawful act, the court has uniformly held that that is protected by the First Amendment, a person's right to free assemble and free speech, because public sidewalk is typically considered a public forum.
Okay. Let me then switch gears into the Landlord Act, where some cities are proposing that if you are leasing, renting to someone in the country illegally, that you are aiding and abetting or harboring an illegal person. And some of the registration and the $1,000 a day fines. Did you do any research on that? And what are the status of some of those?
We have found some of those, Mayor. There is one in Hazleton, Pennsylvania, that we've talked a little bit about already, and also in Riverside, New Jersey. And as the Mayor said, Escondido, also, California, has also adopted a similar ordinance yesterday. The Hazleton, Pennsylvania ordinance is being challenged on the basis of constitutionality. It is they have delayed implementation of the ordinance pending the court case. So in terms of the effectiveness of the ordinance, we can't determine yet since they have not implemented it, and it is currently just in the district court. So we are looking at several years, I believe, before we get a final answer with regard to that issue.
Right. Hazleton did one modification, and I've forgotten what that was. It wasn't just monetary, but other – forgot the language. And so that you – I think
Mayor,
if you compensate without, you do free work or something, so they're trying to figure out another way around it. I thought they modified their slightly. Maybe it's not pertinent anyway.
They did modify it, Mayor, and I can't remember exactly what they added. In terms of the pending litigation, The complaint that was filed with regard to the initial ordinance, and then the council came back and they changed the ordinance. So there has not been an amended complaint filed. So what we're expecting is that soon they will challenge the amended ordinance, and then we'll be basically at the same point we are right now, which is pending in district court.
Okay. One other follow-up. Let me go through my list and throw them out, and then other council members can do the same. The Mexican consulate card that was voted on by this council in February 27, 2003, the police department came forward saying, you know, some identification is better than none. I think that also gained access to the library, and I think I asked whether the library has federal money in which it's a little bit like the schools. Kids are entitled to have access to schooling. Are they also entitled to have access to public libraries, because we have grants and stuff that would require us to not inquire on immigration status and accept any type of ID for library cards and access to the libraries?
Mayor, I was going to fess up and say you asked me that the other day and I forgot to ask, but maybe Mary has the answer.
Actually, the legal ramifications, I don't know, but what I did do was look and see the usage of our counselor ID card. And the main usage that we're finding has been proven to be anecdotal, except for the police department. When we contacted all the departments, there's minimal usage of the counselor ID card in the libraries. Where it is being utilized is the police department, as well as the utilities department. Brian Raines and as well as Chief Gascon will be willing to talk a little bit about that. But in terms of the library, it was minimal usage.
And I guess it ties in a little bit with the fraudulent ID. If we're using that one, then that gives us a second name or a third name if people are reentering in the country. So we run that number or that name, and we get no hit, so we release. Because we don't have control over the production of those or the tamper-proof nature of those or anything else. So that was my question.
And Mayor, I didn't ask about the federal money, but I did look into, and I have, what type of ID does the library accept in issuing a Mesa Public Library card? And I have that information. I think in terms of the question, can we preclude use of the consular card, I think we'd also have to take a look at what else here would have to be excluded. I have not done extensive research on it to determine what the legal issues would be, but I think in terms of issuing a library card, the purpose we require some type of ID is because we have a business reason in terms of wanting some level of assurance that we're going to get the books back or be able to, you know, remain whole with regard to the library. If there were some business justification for removing additional types of ID from the list that it's acceptable, that may be a reason to remove this or any other type of ID. But I think we'd have to go with the business purpose would be my initial reaction, and I probably should fall back on, since I haven't researched it, I don't want to address it. But
well, if we approved it for authorization originally, we could rescind that approval, I would assume.
Right, and I guess what I don't know, and what we did before council approved it, what was the list of authorized identification that the library accepted before council accepted the consular card?
And then we'd have to see those that use the consular card for ID, whether they're returning the books, I guess. Is that what, if you take a full circle, then
and
you
I
have a business purpose for saying we don't want to use that again?
Well, if they're not returning the books, I think we can, just like any other type of ID, if people are not returning the books, we can cancel that ID. I don't think we do that at this point, since I've bought many books, as I know Vice Mayor Walters has, over the years with our kids losing the books.
That's just a confession.
But I again want to state that what we found in terms of the usage was, again, the police department, the courts. They're the ones who are the biggest users of the counselor ID card, and that was the initial impetus for us to go forward with the card, was for a public safety issue.
Right.
And so what we're finding, again, it's very anecdotal, very minimal usage from the library and parks department.
Do you have Peruvian council cards and other ones, too, that are also accepted, or is it just the Mexican one?
At this point, you chose to accept the Mexican council ID card.
And I guess I don't call the discussion. Maybe somebody else does. Were there other consulate cards that we said we don't want those? We just
I think in terms of us, it was the consular ID card is the most prevalent. The Peruvian was consulate was just beginning when we voted this in.
And Mayor, if I could add, the library does now or still accept non-U.S. driver's license, such as Canadian driver's license or Mexican driver's license. They accept a school ID, whether it's a charter, secondary, or college, consular ID, tribal ID, passport, visa, a bank card with a photo, a work ID with a photo, Sam's Club or Costco card with a photo, a resident alien card, and a Mexican voter registration card.
Well, Sam's card's got to be tamper-proof. All right.
So that's why I said we'd have to take a broader look at what is being accepted and what's the business purpose.
I don't remember seeing that list, so I'm impressed. All right. Let's have some other questions here. Mike?
Mayor, on your list of the one that I would be concerned about primarily would be the housing ordinance, because then we would have to investigate the illegal status of someone in order to prosecute that case. We might be getting into the same situation as to investigating illegal status for detention. So that would be a concern there. There is one ordinance that both Councilmember Jones and I have some interest in, I think. I'm going to speak for Kyle, perhaps, and that's the ordinance relative to soliciting employment. Both of our districts are extremely concerned about the large number of day laborers that solicit employment. Not so much the fact that they're there soliciting employment, the fact that they solicit anyone who shows up, whether it be a housewife going to a supermarket or someone going to a business, to the point of jumping in the back of the vehicles or causing fear in the eyes of the residents. I know that from your report, Herndon, Virginia is the one that has that. I'm sure there probably will be some constitutional challenges to that, but that would be one that I would ask staff to look further into, because that would help our community, I believe, along this situation. I realize we don't have a day labor center to send the folks to, but this is something that's a concern to me. And one thing that I would do, if I get council support, to look into that.
Councilmember Whalen, if I might, the Herndon, Virginia ordinance was adopted by council, and it has not been challenged in court, is my understanding. We checked on that just recently. We're now checking to see if there's a date.
We don't have that.
Here it is. This was signed September 13, 2005. So as far as I know at this point, well, what we were told is it has been implemented, and to date, it has not been challenged.
And I don't know how large Herndon, Virginia is and how big of a problem they have.
Mayor and Councilman Whalen, I actually got that ordinance at a city manager's conference. A city manager from that city actually provided it in one of the work sessions. And it was as a result of their difficulties with day labor centers and being able to address that issue. So this was kind of a fallback response. And he was promoting it as something that was being successfully implemented in his community. I'm not sure I would represent, he felt like it had solved all the problems, but it certainly was a large step, and they felt like it was another tool that they had, certainly working with businesses, and that seemed to be the area they wanted to focus on the most.
That appears to be, in my district, the largest complaint that I get, and I'm sure Kyle would probably indicate the same.
Okay. I would certainly be willing to look at additional implementation for day labor solicitation, if that's what it's going to be addressing. So I would concur with, let's move forward and look at the different pros and cons of that issue in a separate session with the study session or something else, or bring back some drafts and let us review them and make suggestions at a later date. So, Vice Mayor.
Thank you, Mayor. I concur. I think that we had some discussion the other day about red curb things and addressing not just illegal solicitation in that regard, but also illegal solicitation that occurs on West Main Street, and whether we could address that issue at the same time. I'm interested in the training on identification of false documents. I think that was that might have been one of the things that you mentioned, or somebody mentioned that in terms of the Alabama folks, that one of the real benefits there was that they had, maybe you said it, Mayor, mm-hmm. that identification on the training for false documents. I'm very, very interested in our folks getting that training, because we also become a first line of defense. You know, we always think of illegal immigration, I think, in terms of our southern border, but there are people who come from all over the world, and some of those people who come from all over the world come here with the intent to harm Americans, and we really want to be a good first line of defense in addressing that issue. That homeland security issue is very important to me. The second piece is those license plate readers. Watch me make Tom go crazy. Has anybody given any thought to, you know, when you've got the red light cameras, can the license plate reader detect vehicles that are going illegally, stolen vehicles that way?
Yes, you can. And as a matter of fact, one of the discussions that I have with a vendor is I would like to see if we can work together and create a pilot program where we get some fixed posts for license plate readers, not only in necessarily tied to an intersection, but tied to some of the major throughfares, as people have to go in and out of a freeway. If you look at London, London has what they call the Ring of Steel, that they have put license plate readers around the city, and they actually have some very interesting uses. It was originally developed for anti-terrorism purposes, but what they're doing now is, for instance, they read unregistered vehicles. So that if you come up with an unregistered vehicle within the Ring of Steel, you get an electronic citation for that. They also, because of the traffic congestion problems in the city, you have to pay a tax in order to drive in the city of London. You can either prepay it, or if not, you get cited for it. The license plate readers will actually register that and help in the enforcement of that. From a crime-fighting stance, it's a very good tool, because what it does is, let's say that we have an incident involving a vehicle, a robbery, a homicide, a shooting, and you may get, if you can go back and look at all the license plates that were read through the immediate area, you can start using that as an investigative tool. You may have a partial license plate, for instance, given by a witness, and now you can marry that to a vehicle that went through a particular intersection or a particular part of the city. Also, you can put wanted vehicles, not only stolen vehicles, but you can put vehicles that are wanted just by the local police department. You can. The uses are really unlimited when it comes to license plate readers. We currently have one vehicle that we use. I would like to obtain funding for at least four so that we have one in each of our stations. The funding, it runs approximately $22,000 for the equipment. It is a very effective tool to fight car theft, but it's also very effective to do all kinds of other investigative activities. And certainly putting some in fixed areas within the city would be very desirable. And we're in dialogue with the vendor, but certainly if there was the ability to get some financial assistance from council, that would certainly expedite the process, because at this point I was trying to see if we could come up with some kind of a beta site agreement and be a pilot program for the vendor, as opposed to being able to say we have money to go out and buy it. So,
thank you. Oh, that was the answer to that question. And then the reconfiguration of the field computers, which we already talked about. But I think if we can have information back on all of this, particularly the one that Mike was talking about, the Herndon, Virginia model, the red curb. And then I had one that I brought up the other day that I think that I'd like to see brought forward. I think we're going to have some conversation on it in November, and that has to do with license, people who have no license. What are we doing right now, Chief, when somebody gets into, and this is a complaint that I get quite a bit, somebody gets into an accident, the person that they have been in the accident with, their perception is that person... Well, it's not just perception. The person doesn't have a license, they don't have, or they have a suspended license, and they don't have insurance. So now you have a person who is a responsible person in the community, who has a license, who has insurance, and all of those things. They get into an accident. What's happening? I think there's been a change in the law recently.
Well, the direction that I've given, apparently sometimes here we were not impounding vehicles. The direction that I found that out when I first got here, the direction that I've given is that we have the authority under state law to impound vehicles when we have an unlicensed driver and we are impounding the vehicle. So that is currently taking place. If you're an unlicensed driver and you come to our attention, either through a vehicle stop or a traffic collision, we will impound your vehicle.
Good. Okay, so we're impounding the vehicle.
Correct.
What about if somebody is... My understanding is that in Arizona, you're required to have insurance.
I believe you do, yes.
So what happens if they're in an accident and they didn't have insurance? Can...
I don't know whether you can impound for that or not.
Mayor, Councilmember Walters, I don't believe that the current state law allows for that. There's two sections of the law. There's mandatory impoundment or immobilization, and then discretionary, and it's not covered under either for solely lack of insurance.
Okay, can somebody get back to me with, you have it right there, Debbie?
Yeah.
Because I was going to say that might be, I had some things that I wanted to address, you know, on a state and a federal level, the one about driving without a license, because right now driving without a license is a civil traffic, it's civil. And I think if you're over the age of 18 and you're driving without a license, that ought to move into the criminal misdemeanor category. That's my opinion. But that's a state statute. And I think that we're going to look into that and bring that back in November. I think we have some things scheduled for November. But I'd be interested in this one as well.
Councilmember, two things. First of all, from reviewing the statute, not having mandatory insurance does not give the officers the ability to impound the vehicle for that and that alone. So that would require a change in the law. The second thing that we had talked about previously was when you are driving without a license, that's a civil infraction. When you're driving with a suspended license, that's a criminal infraction.
Right.
So we have someone who goes and gets a license, has it suspended for whatever reason, has a criminal citation. If you never go to get that license, it's only a civil citation. I feel like I'm giving a how-to speech right now to all the criminals who are watching, but it's a worse situation if you have a suspended license, and I know we talked about you're not comfortable with that, and
right,
that's another legislative aspect you'd like us to look at.
But I think that we weren't going to go deeply into that today and the pros and cons of all of it, and I don't want to go in deeply today into the pros and cons of the insurance issue that I just raised. But I'd like that on the table for our, I think it's a November discussion.
I believe that we're coming back to you with a whole package on nuisances and how to deal with all kinds of things. By the way, if I may digress for a moment. If you would like, I would very much like to start the process to get our folks to be training how to deal with fraudulent license and identifications. We can get the state liquor board to do it for us, and we probably should host it for the region. It's not a Mesa problem, it's a region problem. So I would be very glad to spearhead that and begin that process to get that training going.
I would very much like that, but I just speak for me.
Okay. Rex.
One of the areas that concerned me is the legal smuggling coyotes in the slum landlords and drop houses that aid and abet them. ICE raided 6 of our finer motels, and we're going to seize them and take them over, and I haven't heard anything for 6 months now. Do you know anything on their process, or they just dropped the ball as usual?
Councilmember Griswold, I don't know the status, since that is an ICE enforcement program. We are not involved, and they have not communicated with me, nor would they typically.
Okay. One of the cities I saw, they did a license for landlords, and they were working on so many people unrelated in a household. Was that one of the states had? One of the cities. I was looking through some of the model codes.
I'm sorry. I'm not sure which one you're referring to, Councilmember Griswold.
I was looking through my notes, too. I just jotted it down on there, but they were working with the drop houses and the one way is licensing landlords and going through that way. I wondered if there was any
Hazleton,
more research on that.
Hazleton requires anyone seeking to rent a dwelling in the city to apply to the city for a residency license.
That was the Hazleton. Yes,
that's
Hazleton. And has that been upheld or not?
That is currently being challenged in district court.
That's, you know, one of the large problems we're having. We're going to be the slumlord investment of choice and followed closely behind the drop house of choice. So both those I'd like to be able to work on.
the slumlord, if we're talking about a housing ordinance, we have to be mindful of the charter, which specifically requires that that go to a vote.
So be it.
Yeah, that then requires interior inspection at some level.
That's correct,
Mayor. That's been the issue on that. All right. Let's go down here to Scott first.
Thank you, Mayor. In reading the thank you for this information, by the way, it's very helpful. And as I read through the bullet points here of all these cities that have taken some action against landlords or placed a regulation on business, I see nothing in here that indicates anything that's internal. What are these cities doing to ensure that the people they employ are legal? What is the city of Mesa doing? We have hundreds of thousands of dollars of contracts that go out, the private sector, for sewers to roads, and what are we doing to ensure that those folks, the people that are working for Mesa, either directly or through contract, are here legally?
Councilmember Summers, I can tell you that the city of Mesa, in terms of our application process, we do have a form that we require all potential employees to fill out called Employment Eligibility Verification, and included in that is a series of information that's required to be submitted. So the city of Mesa does take steps with regard to that. In terms of the contracts that we issue, we have clauses contained in the contract that require that the contractor ensure that citizenship of the employees.
Who enforces that? It's a pretty nebulous statement to say to somebody, you have to make sure that everybody working for you is illegal, but nudge and a wink, we're not checking.
I don't know that we send people out to check. I don't know that we are sending people out to check. I would believe that would be very difficult for us. But maybe Ed knows more than I do.
One of the issues that we did run into several years ago, and it continues to be an issue for us, is the Privacy Act. These are employees of that vendor, and therefore there may not be an opportunity for us to see that same amount of information that the employer obtains to verify that that employee is eligible to or legally living and working in the United States.
Something I'd like to look at, Mr. Mayor, is have our attorney come up with an opinion on that particular aspect and what options are available to make sure that the folks that are doing some work with the city are abiding by our laws.
There may be some way that they need to be granted some type of security clearance, which you can get around that then if they're going to be employed in parks and stuff around the city that might necessitate another level that we can put in the contracts or something. All right. Kyle.
Thank you, Mayor. As we've been talking through all these things this morning, it goes back to really the stuff we've been talking about from the time I started on the council, and I started asking other council members who have been here longer than I, the work they've done going with that National League of Cities, going back, sitting in the congressional offices, talking about this whole issue and what we as cities can do, and pleading with them to work on it. And we're aware in the news what's taking place of building fences and so forth. I have been serving on the National League of Cities Public Safety and Crime Prevention for the last few years, and also last year served on the NLC Task Force for Immigration. And we spent many, many hours going over much of what we're talking about right now. And we sat in Washington, D.C. with many groups making presentations, giving us statistics. We went to the White House, talked with White House staff. And really, the message that came back that is our biggest challenge to us as cities, because as I sit in these meetings with city representatives, elected officials, from all across the country, literally, and we're pretty much all in the same boat. We want to address it, but our biggest challenge is our limitations because we're preempted by federal law. There's only so much we can do to be constitutionally challenged on what we can do. And so the discussion we're doing today is really looking where can we approach that line without spending all our time in court, and that's what we're trying to accomplish here, is getting that information out. Interestingly enough, our frustrations, and when we had the state representative here earlier, is trying to get the cooperation from the federal government is challenging at best, because no matter what kind of legislation they pass, historically they have not funded what they need to make it happen. We don't have the proper funding for ICE, for the Border Patrol. We don't have enough there for them to do the job, because what people don't understand is we can detain, we can arrest, we can bring in people who are, well, first and foremost, a criminal element, and finding out then that they are people who have previous records, we need to deport them, need to get them out, but we're not getting the full cooperation from the federal government. That is our biggest challenge. And people just have to understand that we are limited in how much we can do there. But from the city standpoint, what we're looking at is how far we do we go. The impeding of business, and I've spoken with each of you on more than one occasion to address this and the challenge that it is to businesses in our city, in my district. So anything that we can do, and I appreciate information from Chief Gascon, that we can continue working on improving our equipment in the field. I would like to look at the fingerprinting, because you don't get the information. You know, no one's going to give you the right name if they're trying to avoid you. So I think we need to implement whatever we can and bring that back through the process, and I think there will probably be support to do that. As far as solicitation, I think we need to find whatever verbiage we can so that we can address it. The picking up soliciting business for those who don't want to be solicited. All these aspects, but the bottom line is, and people need to understand, we're doing what we can. Yeah, go ahead, Mike.
I don't know what you mean by that one.
I'm going to behave and not repeat some things from previous, Mike.
All right. So.
But I appreciate the information, and I think some folks were assuming that we were going to make all kinds of decisions this morning, and what our intent was to gather as much information as we could so that we could start the process wherever we decide is going to be the best avenue to be most effective and to give us the best result that we can. But my plea overall is we'll do all we can in the city, but people have got to step up at a different level, and that's going to probably take a lot of grassroots effort, like was spoken earlier on. To strongly encourage the federal government to cooperate with us better.
Okay. I'm going to go back to my original comments on the 287G program. I think one of the things the federal government has now available that was a tool that was not available before is to cross-train local police officers or DPS or whoever is the best in the state of Arizona that we can collaborate with. And it may not be Mesa police officers, but to have an ICE presence to a higher degree than we do today. So I am encouraging an MOU being drafted, and I'm not sure what the entity will be. I don't know if the incarceration is the best place to do it, whether it's the Mesa police, whether it's the state highway patrol. I'm not locking into an entity, but I think that we do have a window that has not been opened before to enter into a memorandum of understanding to have some of those powers so we're not preempted, but we can be a partner with the federal government to enforce immigration laws. So, but I am not to a point where I know the outline of that program. I'd like to hear from, you know, the police chief and the law enforcement community. The governor, it needs to be a collaborative effort, in my opinion, in the state of Arizona, and not each city just doing their own thing. So, but I would not want to turn our back on that avenue. I think that
with three or four other states doing it, and Alabama and what they're doing at their motor vehicle to have a good Alabama license that is not fraudulent, because if you come in and they're ICE officers there running who's applying for licenses, and if they get arrested coming in there asking for fraudulent documentation or presenting some, you know, they're going to get arrested. So my information from Alabama is that's been very successful. I'd like to follow up on that 287G program with the city of Mesa to figure out whether we should or who we should collaborate with to make that program stronger and embrace it here in the state of Arizona. So that would be my desire. In order to move these forward, I think we probably, for the city manager's sake, we need to have some kind of concurrence that I'm not the only one, because I don't want you to go through all that work and have a 6-1 vote again or something like that. So I want to, at least on that issue, I'm looking for concurrence because I'm not sure I have it. So, Tom.
Well, I was going to go through the whole litany of, and that's included if you want, or I can just identify that one.
Well, let's go through. If somebody wants to keep tabs, and then if you want to ask for...
I have a list, as we've been going through, that I've tried to...
Go ahead.
Okay, let me answer that one first. I'm not interested in having the city of Mesa alone enter into any kind of MOU with the federal government. I don't want to divert our police resources from DUIs and murders and burglaries into the enforcement of federal laws. So... But in terms of exploring whether or not there's not an opportunity for some kind of regional or statewide MOU, I don't have an objection to us pursuing that, but I'm not interested at all in having the city enter into one on its own. I don't think it's our job, particularly if we're going to start doing license plate readers and fingerprint wireless stuff. We're going to be spending some extra money, and we don't have it, and I don't think it's an appropriate use. But exploring a regional one, Mayor, I don't have a problem with at least starting to look at the outlines. But on the rest of them, I guess I sort of have to preface my comments by two things that I don't want to do. After having read the news reports about the intelligent agency's summary of how little progress we've made on the war on terror, despite the surrender of some of our civil liberties, I'm really not interested in surrendering any more of our civil liberties in an effort to combat this problem. And politically, and I'm really tired of this being the whipping boy, the illegal immigration being the whipping boy issue that gets used by every politician and unscrupulous follower of a politician to get it twisted. So I'm just tired of it being the political ploy tool of the 2000s. So having said that, my goal here is to make sure that we don't do anything that's unconstitutional, that we don't do anything that is a violation of civil liberties, and that we don't do anything that strengthens our big government mentality more than it needs to. So having said that, let me just say, on the housing issue, I certainly don't want to do anything like what Hazleton does, which is require people to get a license in order to live in your city. First of all, I have some real questions about the constitutionality of that. I also have questions about the cost of it, because we're not going to certainly, it requires an investigation of citizen status. No community is going to conduct that investigation without incurring a cost, so we're going to have to charge a fee for the license. So we're now going to charge people for a license so that they can live in our city. That might help with our growth problem, but it's not an appropriate thing for the government to do. Secondly, I have some real concerns about how that policy and how that program would get enforced without running afoul of some fair housing requirements. I mean, I just don't see how a landlord or a city makes the kind of inquiries that need to be made in order to make sure that somebody is not an illegal alien without running afoul of the Fair Housing Act. And there might be a line there that somebody else can figure out who's a lot smarter than I am, but I have it's a very thin line, and it's one that has dangerous repercussions. So I don't want to go there, because I don't think there's anybody who can walk that line. So I don't want to get involved in housing penalties for people who either rent or for people who rent to people who don't have a license or charge them $1,000 a day for renting to illegal aliens. I don't want to repeal the use of the consular cards. I don't want to restrict it to just Mexican consular cards. If there are other countries that have them, I don't think we ought to be country-specific in our acceptance of them. If they're good cards, we should just continue to use them. They serve a legitimate police function. They serve a legitimate utility function. I think they're probably helpful to the court system. And speaking to the courts, Claudia, if you want to change the driving without a license to a criminal traffic, the judge might agree with you because you might need two extra courtrooms. On the license plate readers, I have no objections to the law so long as they're used for identifying stolen vehicles, used for identifying partial plates or something that has been with a current crime.
Right.
What I don't want to have is a database that's developed and maintained so that the government can figure out where everybody has been in the pursuit of a legitimate travels and movements around the community. So I'm serious. If you had a reader and it scanned every license plate, and those that didn't either get a hit for a stolen vehicle or a warrant, or there was no crime in that immediate area so that you can use it, as you said, Chief, that information needs to be downloaded, dumped, deleted, however you do it. I just do not want to create databases of people's legitimate travels around this community.
And we would probably come up with a protocol that the data is dumped every 48 hours or every 72
exactly.
hours.
And no
you
more
need enough time. Because sometimes a crime occurs and you figure it out and you're looking, you need a couple, two or three or four days.
I agree with that. I'm not suggesting that it needs to be every hour, but the creation of a database is you haven't heard this, but the people at this council have heard before that I have spent some time on the streets of Havana where there are cameras recording everybody who's there walking around on the streets, and I don't want to get this country ever to that place. Cannot support, will not support any kind of anti-loitering statute. I don't see how you can do it constitutionally. I don't see how you can do an impeding business statute. Think you're going to violate people's rights. You're going to violate people's constitutional rights. Impeding access, I think I have some problem with that, although I'm willing to look at it. I think we already have a statute that says you can't impede access to a building or a business. You can't block the driveway on the sidewalk, isn't that right? Now, if you're talking about, do you have to walk around people because they've got the sidewalk blocked? Hasn't happened yet, but if Jeff gets his transportation plan going, and we probably have thousands of people on the buses, so they'll be standing out at the bus stops, and you know we have to be able to distinguish between people who were there for the bus stops versus people who were there for trying to get me to pull in and have their car washed by some cute little girls in bikinis and this kind of stuff. So I mean, we got to realize that there are other uses for our sidewalks other than people who are trying to obtain work. I agree that we need to make our computers in the field accessible to the NCIC subfield as soon as possible. I have a question about the anti-solicitation statute before I make my comment. Is it a crime for a person who is in the country illegally to work? Is that a separate crime for the worker?
I don't believe so, but I'm not sure of that.
Right. I know there is a federal crime for large, certain size employers who hire illegal aliens. You have to have two forms of ID or a passport or all these things. So my concern with the anti-solicitation ordinance is, I know it's hard to separate, but once the person has crossed the border illegally, which is the illegal act, they're here, they are persons. And I think we have a tendency to forget that these are people, and we tend to talk about them in terms of numbers and in terms of crimes and in terms of political rhetoric, but we forget that they're people. And the Constitution talks about persons, not citizens, have certain protections. If they're here, they have a right to work, if it's not a separate crime. And if that's the case, then I have a difficult time making it a crime for someone to solicit to try to get to do that which they are legally entitled to do, and depending upon the size of the employer. So I'd be more willing to do it from the employer standpoint, not the employee standpoint, but I need to know how we make sure that that employer is big enough to be covered by, because I don't want people to be criminal. I don't want criminalized conduct that is the pursuit of something that's legal. Solicitation to commit an act of prostitution. We've had several people come into our chambers and say, this is the same as soliciting to commit an act of prostitution. No, it's not. Soliciting to go to work is not a crime. Soliciting to commit another crime is a crime. So we need to be very careful how we craft that. But I'm willing to look at it from the employer standpoint. However, we need to realize that, at least in my area, I see signs all the time, and I'm assuming if there can be a sign, there can be a person holding that sign that basically says, you want to make $200,000 a week? You know, sales calls. You want to do this? Call us for a job in this area. You know, there are employment signage on our streets. I mean, does that preclude somebody who, you know, only white Protestant males need apply? I mean, so we don't have an illegal alien thing? I mean, we have to be careful. I don't know how you draft it. I think it's very troublesome as to how to draft. I'm just tired of this. I mean, I dressed up like this today because I thought maybe John Kyle would be here and he'd need another big hat for one of his commercials. But, you know, Abraham, and I paraphrase Abraham Lincoln when he said that we first started off with everybody creating equal. I have to say this in a politically correct way, of course, because he didn't use these words exactly. He says, and then we decided everybody's created equal except blacks. And then we decided that everybody's created equal except blacks and Catholics. This was during the know-nothing period of the 1850s. Then everybody is created equal except blacks and Catholics and Chinese. And then we added Germans and Eastern European people in the 1890s and the 1900s. Now we're adding Hispanics. I think if we had Canadians coming across our borders, nobody would care. What we're doing is we're stamping a sense of this is destroying our culture on it. And to me, that has a racist undertone that I can't tolerate, that I can't stand. And I'm willing to do some very rifle shot things in order to address this problem. But I am not willing to go very far because I do not want to be a part of this hysteria that has seized the political atmosphere in this country.
Okay. Other comments, Mike? I know you've got.
Premier, I have to leave. I am not in support of the city of Mesa entering specifically as a city alone into an MOU to enforce immigration law. I would be willing to look at some sort of a strike force or combined task force with the state, perhaps the county, or perhaps they're the best ones to do it. I've pretty much stated my position on the others. I think we need to keep the matricula card. I think that it helps public safety. One other instance I'd like to throw out real quick. Chief, there's some indication that we have some high crime areas within the city, that there's some illegal narcotics trafficking. I know Councilmember Rawls is probably going to flip on this one, but I would like to look at the possibility of entertaining some surveillance cameras that would help law enforcement deal with the criminal element in certain parts of the community.
And, you know, that is something that we're looking into. I've used it very successfully in Los Angeles. We had certain areas that were a tremendous problem for us for years, like MacArthur Park. We would put a lot of cops there. We quelled the problem. As soon as we left, the problem came back. We went to camera surveillance. Initially, we were monitoring the cameras around the clock. Then we went down to about 40 hours a week. The reality is that the park has become one of the cleanest places in the city. And certainly it's a force multiplier, and if it's used thoughtfully, and I, Councilman Rawls, I fully agree with you. One of the things that I'm very proud of living in this country is the greatness of our Constitution, and the last thing that I want to do is create a police state here. But having said that, there is a use for technology that, if it's used thoughtfully, can be very helpful. You should also know that as part of the reorganization of the department, we're going to be creating the street crime fighting units that will be at each of the stations that are going to be composed of narcotics, gang enforcement. We're also going to be embedding some federal partners into the mix, and we're going to be going very aggressively after gang activities, narcotics activity, and those areas that are high crime, regardless of where the person came from. You know, I have absolutely no tolerance and no patience for criminal activity, and certainly you hire me to do just that, and I'm going to look for every potential tool that I have access to in order to answer to your needs and the needs of the city.
Thank you.
Kyle, how are you on
the 287G? I am not interested in doing it specifically as a community alone. If we want to do it, I want to do it regionally or statewide. And the only reason it would be is the MOQ would be to make ICE do their job and pick the people up, whatever method we can do to make that happen. The catch and release is worthless. It's pointless. Following Tom is interesting because he always goes through with his lawyer background and addressing everything so specifically, and I appreciate that. And I agree in many aspects of what Tom said of we don't need to address it as trying to be so specific, because number one, if you make any kind of ordinance to where it is crafted strictly as an immigration ordinance, it's going to get shot down in court. It's not going to be constitutional. We know that. It's happened all across the country, and what our officers and our resources need to be focused on is fighting crime. We need to provide the public safety for the individuals in our community. Now, part of that public safety problem has been exacerbated by people who come in and create, you know, the stealing of the cars and all the things that have gone with it, the gangs, the drug activity. But it's not primarily on one group of people. It's citywide. And your focus is to utilize all the resources that we can provide you to fight crime. That is the first and foremost focus. Since this morning is talking more about immigration, of how we can address part of that, again, I go back to the experience I've had the last few years meeting with and talking with a host of people across the country. And until we have something to address the root of the problem, which is a supply and demand, you have people who are coming here because they're looking for a better life, they're looking for work, and they're going to be coming no matter what type of enforcement is in place, no matter how big you build a wall, no matter how many people you put on the border, they're going to get here because they believe that their life is going to be better, they're going to find work. The ability to have the appropriate number of people here to work legally with appropriate documentation, until that program is in place, until the feds decide to fix the system that they have allowed to get worse and worse over the years, we are not going to be able to fix that here in our community. We can't. It's not feasible. We can't fix it as a state. It has to be fixed on a federal level. So regardless of anything that we try to do, we have to craft it in such a way that it is constitutional. We all have to recognize and accept that. So when we're looking at the license plate readers, very legitimate uses for it. We need to take a good hard look at how to implement that. Configuring the field laptops, not just for the NCIC subset, but also the wireless fingerprinting. That is very valuable to us, regardless of who we're confronting, regardless of what their ethnic background is. A criminal's a criminal, period.
And if they're giving you wrong information, they're giving you invalid IDs, because invalid IDs come in all shapes and colors. And we need to be able to address that. So I have no problem with looking at the readers, configuring our field information. As far as the matricula, when we addressed that, we as a council made it very clear, because we were pressed to say yay or nay at that time. I remember the discussion very well, and we said we don't want to take away the matricula as a source of ID for people. We will accept it, but only as ID. It does not guarantee any services, does not give anything extra. It is a form of ID, and we recognize another government's ID. And that was all it was, as I recall that discussion. I think we have the minutes supporting that. So taking away the matricula as just a form of ID, I don't think we need to look at that. It's a legitimate ID, but you have all kinds of counterfeit on both sides of the border. So, but it is a, if it is strictly as a form of ID, we stick with it. I'm not real interested in the housing issue as it was presented in, which community was it? It was Hazleton, Pennsylvania. All you're doing is opening a quagmire of issues. That would be nothing but a nightmare. I'm not interested in that at all. And I think I've touched on most of it, so I'll leave it at that.
Okay, thank you. We'd like to go first on this side, just to make sure that staff has their ideas. Vice Mayor?
Sure. Be glad to. Thank you, Mayor. I have very strong feelings for the Constitution. I took a con law class when I was in college. It was not a required course for my major. I took it because I was so interested in it. And as a woman, I would note that Abraham Lincoln didn't mention women because everybody assumed women didn't have any rights. Women didn't get rights until the 20th century. I can count on the digits of my hands and feet the number of women who have served on the Mesa City Council, because women didn't get the right to vote until, I think, about 1920. I should actually have the date memorized. So one of the concerns I've had about this discussion, I've had a couple of concerns, and I really need to compliment the mayor on the way he has conducted this discussion, because I had real fears that we were in the process here, that we might give safe harbor to xenophobics or people who really had very prejudicial feelings towards people of particular races, and I couldn't be party to that. And, Mayor, you really have done, I think, an amazing job of keeping us away from that, and I really appreciate it, because as I've had conversations probably with Keno probably 5 or 6 times over the last couple of months, telling him how anxious that has made me, because I don't want to be a party to that. I have at various points in my life been discriminated against on the basis of all kinds of things. I'm short, I'm a woman, and believe it or not, some people hate people with red hair. Hard to believe, but true.
Cowboy hats.
Or cowboy hats, yes, it happens with cowboy hats too. I was also concerned because the expectations for what the city of Mesa could do as a city are so high. I mean, there's rhetoric in the press that suggests that somehow cities have a lot more power to do things here than we do. And the law is incredibly complex. And Ms. Spinner, as you have pointed out, that line on illegal presence versus illegal entry is so difficult. And the federal government has that power, and we don't have that power. And so, you know, I thought what we're going to do is more rearranging of the deck chairs on the Titanic, directing folks in the band to play a few different tunes, and ignoring the iceberg that we just crashed into on our bow. And that was a real concern to me. I do think that we've identified some things that are legitimate things that we can do to improve public safety in our community and address issues of illegal immigration in our community. In terms of the MOU on the 287G program, we have a new ICE director coming into the state, and this job that I'm in has made me somewhat of a cynic, frankly. I used to be more optimistic than I am, but I'm finding I have reemergence of optimism in my life, and I am optimistic that we can forge a great relationship with this new director of ICE. And so what I'd like to do, Mayor, is give direction to our staff to work on an Alabama model. I like that model with the DPS being involved, and there are good reasons for having DPS be the trainers, be the individuals who are trained because of how they move all over the state. And if there's a, if we think it works out well to have a member of our staff go and be part of a regional team, I'm in support of a regional team approach. I think a single city approach isn't the best way to go, but I'm really in favor of doing that. And I think if we lend our voice to that effort, I think it'll mean a lot more. Obviously, the state is frustrated. They would have liked to have had a model that's, and as you pointed out, Alabama has the very model that Arizona wanted and Arizona couldn't get. So I'd like to see us support that model. I think the other things that I went through, I went through the list. I think the only other one that I didn't address, if there's something else I need to weigh in and that I've forgotten, please tell me, but the biometrics on licenses. I had mentioned that to the lady from the state, but I'd like to include that on our package of things that we address when we lobby the state, because those biometrics become incredibly important for a whole host of reasons, not the least of which how easy it is for people to get a false identification of any type. That was really frightening to me to look at that and have her say, within 90 minutes, you can have this. That's just frightening. And it's frightening from the aspect of our homeland security. So I want us to pursue that as well. Is there something else I haven't weighed in on that I need to, Mayor?
Vice Mayor, I'm not yes. sure. And Mayor, I'm going to ask you if I can go over my little list here to at the end. But for now, yes. I wasn't sure where you were in terms of the Hazleton housing ordinance.
Let's let Hazleton bear all the legal costs and go through the constitutional arguments and everything else. That's in court. They've even suspended. They're not doing that right now. Imagine how much money it would cost for us to set up a department in a city of 500,000 people. I've been to Hazleton. Hazleton, you know, to paraphrase that old line, Mesa. Hazleton isn't a Mesa. My mother grew up not too far from Hazleton. Yeah, I know Mesa. Hazleton is no Mesa. The size of Hazleton is much more compact than Mesa. I'm imagining the cost and what that would entail and the legal things. And I think Tom's assessment of the legality of all of that, the constitutional issues there are just absolutely amazing. I guess I should have asked first. My husband and I own some rental properties. My understanding is I'm not precluded from discussing this.
That's
because
correct.
Okay. All right. Was there something else I missed?
The consular card and the anti-loitering ordinance, if you're interested in more information on either of those two.
Well, I had asked for the additional information on the Herndon.
On Herndon, right.
On that's Herndon.
That's illegal solicitation.
Right.
In terms of blocking the sidewalk,
I don't know how you do it. I mean, I started driving around the city. Kyle had mentioned something to me about the loitering statutes, and I started driving around the city, and watching people standing talking to each other on the sidewalk, and I thought, okay, well now are they loitering? So I think you have to address it from the solicitation standpoint, because you know now you've been talking. Tom and I stood on the sidewalk the other day and talked for about 5 minutes, and I said, am I now loitering because we've been standing here talking for 5 minutes? I think you're going to have to address the activity that's going on as opposed to the just standing there aspect of things. I think I don't know constitutionally how we deal with that. Well, and I've had children who have exercised that right at various points in time in their life. And by the way, Chief, I jotted a note down to myself because it just tickled me when you cited MacArthur Park. I think all of us who grew up in the 60s and 70s know that the problem there is all that sweet green icing flowing down.
Sure.
So what was the other one, Debbie?
The consular card.
Yeah. I think the reason we had gone with that, my recollection from 3 years ago, I beg your pardon, was because the police chief had come to us and had said some identification was more helpful to them in terms of dealing with crime than no identification at all, and that was the reason. Now, I know that there were concerns that people had about that somehow this granted somebody some sort of status. What I'd like to know is, has there been a change in all that? So I'd like some more information back to know whether there has been a change in that, how it's been used. What I heard today was anecdotal, and if our current chief has a different take on that, my intent was to help. We want good criminal enforcement in our community.
The advantage of having any type of identification that can be confirmed whether it's good ID or not is that it gives us another tool. We have the ability to confirm with the Mexican consulate whether, in fact, a particular matricula is a good one or not. Also, the technology on the matricula itself continues to improve. I met with the Consul General of Mexico just to have a discussion whether it was time to start training our people in recognizing whether these things are valid or not. But I think the discussion that took place today is going to give us the room. What we're going to do is we're going to spearhead a process regionally just to go very globally, bring in the state and train our law enforcement people in how to identify fraudulent pieces of identification, which will include the Mexican matricula. But just so that you know, for instance, about 20% of our in our jail activities, approximately 80 people a month use the matricula as a piece of identification in order to provide some form of ID to the jailing personnel. As far as vehicle impounds and releases and other forms of identification, our central station is running about 5 or 8 per day, which is roughly about 25% of the traffic at that station. At our headquarters front desk is running at around 20%, and that's roughly about 6 to 8. So there's a substantial use of this form of identification, as well as many others. So I think it's a tool. It doesn't grant anybody any status in any shape, but it does give us another tool to be able to see who we're talking to. And quite frankly, even if they're giving us a false piece of ID, sometimes that helps us to see if they're lying to us because of the way that they're using the identification. So I don't think that taking it away is not gonna make any impact on crime. It's not, people are not being allowed to get away with crime because they're carrying a matricula. It's just another tool in the bag.
And my recollection, and I'm glad you were saying those things, because part of my recollection of this is, and let me go back to Tom's comment about cards from other places. I didn't even understand why we were doing it in the first place, because what prevents you from taking, I mean, if I show you my passport and I'm from Chile, then you use my passport. I guess the objection that I had to that was that it was singling something out that I thought was inappropriate to be singled out. So in some ways, I don't want to have it because I think it gives some sort of super status to something that shouldn't have super status. It's just like any other form of ID. If you have a driver's license from Canada, if you have a passport from South Africa, if you have and let me keep on going. I can name identification things from all over the world. Why do we give super status to this one? I don't think we should. I guess, my feeling would be we accept all of those things. And maybe that's the thing we should say, that we accept, that we use those things as tools. The word accept, I think, is the problem. They are tools that are used by our folks in the city in order to do their jobs. It doesn't give somebody particular status, and so my concern is that by putting that out there like that, that somehow we have given that perception. I don't think there's a reality to it, but if somebody wants to come back with something broader that says that we're taking all of those things, I guess I would like that, Mayor.
Good idea. Rex?
I wanted to commend the mayor also for having this discussion, having the guts to do it. Very few cities I've seen in the Valley have had the guts to do this discussion, look for solutions. Even to have the discussion, you get vilified in the press by people that hate Mesa. So it takes some guts to step out there and look at different things than what is the problem, how big is it, and how do you get a handle on it. The first part of it is the crime aspect of it. Whatever it is. I believe in giving the chief all the tools he wants. The wireless fingerprinting, the connecting the police computers to the NCIC, the LPR, the license plate reader, those are all tools you should have in your tool bag and be able to reduce crime in our city. Whatever ethnic person is doing a crime should be put away and get off our streets as fast as possible and stay off our streets. A 287G program, regional program, I'm in favor, particularly if it involved the sheriff. You know, we're paying $130 a night when we send somebody over to Sheriff Joe. It comes out of our budget, your tax money. You know, every time we arrest somebody, he's raising that again this year, mainly due to liability and lawsuits he's getting. So we're all paying for it. So everybody we send over there, we're paying more. So whatever we can do to cut that amount, I'd be in favor of. I'd be willing to look at an anti-solicitation ordinance. Didn't mean I'd be in favor of it, but I would like to look at some language and see if it would, if it does anything. A lot of times we do these feel-good things that makes everybody feel good. They're worthless. I don't want to pass another one of those. I'd like to look at the problem of our slum landlords and our drop houses. I don't know what the solution is, but I'm willing to look at what's worked in other cities, what people do, and come up with a solution to it. I agree with Vice Mayor Walters. The matricula card, to me, is a non-issue. It's one form of ID. I'm more interested in who's the other person on the other end. If you can fingerprint somebody right there, you'll find out whether they're a felon, they've entered this country, you know, illegally twice, some other things about them. So those are, I think, most of my feelings.
Okay. Scott?
Thank you, Mayor. Frankly, I'm disappointed today because what I was hoping to do is hear some of the tools that we can get to enforce this, and what I find is that there's more obstacles than there are tools available to local governments. You look at the 2006 Arizona State Legislators agenda here on illegal immigration, there are 18 Senate bills and House bills, one of them passed. I'm looking at a list, failed, not just vetoed, two were vetoed, the rest failed, didn't even get out of the House. So it's a struggle for cities to try to enforce this. That being said, I think that we've heard a few things, opportunities, 287G being one of them, that are tools that had not been here before that we ought to pursue. Starting down the line, let's look at some of the police. I think the wireless fingerprinting has some applications beyond just illegal immigration that should be looked at. The NCIC Connect, quite frankly, we should have been connected to that before.
It's a subset, but we are connected
to the subset, right.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
We just found out this morning that was the case. So
yeah, I'm surprised that we weren't.
Assuming that was the case, that's...
We need to get hooked up to that right away. I am a little concerned about going too far with this, the idea of cameras, the idea of license plate readers. We're getting a little Orwellian here in the city, and it's hard to draw that line, but we have to really look how we draw it. I mean, the license plate readers to track the location of where I'm concerned about where this technology could go. We put this on intersections. We'll be able to track where the city manager is at all times, and I know that some people want to do that, but for your wife.
We'll put a direct line to your house.
Your wife knows where you are. She's. So I'm a little concerned where we go with that, but some of the legitimate tools, the fingerprinting, the NCIC Connect, those we should look at. The others I'm a little cautious on. 287G, it would be far more effective if this were regional, Mayor, but I think we should pursue it anyway and see what some of the options are. I do caution, however, that what law enforcement can do legitimately, and at some point we're going to trip over ourselves in that we're going to make it more difficult for your officers to do their jobs, to talk to witnesses, to get reports from witnesses on other crimes, drug use, spousal abuse, those kind of things. I want to help enforce this law, but not restrict our officers and the duties that they can perform and put up some barriers. Herndon has a rule that I want to look at, which has to do with solicitation and how that's being picked up. As well, let me see if I can find that list. The other one I thought that was interesting was Vista, California, that requires anyone picking up employees from the street has to have a license from the city. Right now, that's being challenged as unconstitutional. So I want to follow that one, not enact it. But let's follow that, see where it goes. I think that one has some possibilities, depending on what the lawsuit is. The Herndon one's not being challenged. That may be an opportunity for an ordinance we want to look at. And my final issue is with city employment. I want to make sure that the city is doing all it can to ensure that the people directly employed, sounds like we're doing a good job, but what about the people? Hundreds of thousands of dollars in contracts go out of this, off of this council every month, and I want to know what the tools are to make sure that the people that are working for the city indirectly through private contract are indeed legitimate. I mean, we got to talk the talk, walk the walk as well. So I think that's an important part. If you want me to address the issue about the consular cards, we got to really separate wheat from the chaff here. And I don't think the consular cards, when I heard that you can just go over to Sam's Club, get a picture ID, and that works too, we eliminate the consular cards. We're just going to have them all going over to Sam's Club. If it's a legitimate police tool, that's fine. If it's creating a problem, that's another thing. But, you know, if somebody...
By the way, we don't use Sam's car, so that's the library.
The library uses a Sam's card. You're not using the...
Costco. Only Costco.
Oh, Costco you can
Costco.
Use.
We do use Costco.
Okay. Well, that's different.
It is.
So, I need another sip. All right. So, Costco, Sam's Club. If the consular cards are creating a legitimate problem with illegal immigration, that's one thing, but I really think this is chaff. This isn't wheat. Let's really deal with the serious issues. What can the city do legitimately to help out? And I think we have some tools that the police can use, the 287G. I support the mayor on that. And then looking at a few ordinances to help clean up our streets a little bit. And that's a good first step. Thank you, Mayor.
Can I summarize, Mayor? And please let me know if there's any disagreement. What I believe the direction is that we will continue to look at and try to draft some type of ordinance which is similar to the Herndon, Virginia ordinance that deals with illegal solicitation of day labor. And also, council gave direction for the police department to consider the IT fix for the PD computers, also for PD to consider cross-training for ID falsification of documents, and also for license plate readers. We're going to bring back information in November with regard to Vice Mayor Walters on the red curb issues, the driving without insurance and driving without a license. The MOU, we will look into, can we create more of a regional MOU with ICE and the other partners here in the Valley?
I think I actually counted a 5-2 on do not focus on it being a MESA MOU, but if we're going to do one at all, it would have to be something that would be regional. So.
Correct.
All right.
Gave direction for the police to consider the wireless fingerprinting technology. Now, this I didn't have actually enough votes, but what I have appears as though the council is not moving forward with any type of ordinance similar to the Hazleton ordinance.
That's correct.
Okay. The consulate card we will continue to treat as we had in the past, and we will not go forward at this point with an attempt to draft an anti-loitering ordinance.
I think there was a little bit more on the consulate in that Claudia's concept of any identification. Don't single that one out and maybe change the wording that any and all identification will be used, because I think that's what gave it the special status.
Okay.
All right.
But, Mayor, Debbie, what did you say on the anti-solicitation? What were your
that
votes?
We are going to go forward and...
Oh, we are. Okay.
Yes.
I misunderstood what you said. I'm sorry.
The one question I do have was Councilmember Summers asked twice, should we do additional research to see what, if anything, can the city of Mesa do to ensure that contractors that we enter into contracts with are hiring legal citizens for that work?
Yes.
I concur on it. All right. Okay. I think you've got enough to go on that one.
Okay.
Tom?
One comment on the technology issues that we discussed with the police department. I think, Chief, you're probably smart enough to know that we haven't this wasn't an Appropriations Committee meeting.
Right. No, I do. You mean I don't have a blank check to go?
I was ready to encumber half a million dollars.
Yeah,
this was a direction to come back to us with some specific proposals for specific items with some specific cost.
And I will do so.
Mayor?
Yes.
Mayor, I also want to, going back to a comment the Vice Mayor made about the hope for a relationship with ICE in the future, I can tell you already that the police department has already been in contact with the new representative from ICE. And all indications are, and I'm not sure I can be the person making the announcement, but the place he is coming from, he is very well respected by the local law enforcement and has a very good reputation. We're working with them. So we've already made contact with this individual, and indications are, from what we've talked to others, is that's the reputation he has. So we are hopeful and looking forward to a good relationship with the next ICE administration. So.
Okay. That's all right. I had, Mayor and Council.
Okay. That will take care of item two then. Thank you very much. Good discussion. Item number three is discuss and provide direction on a draft letter to a congressional delegation regarding the need for federal immigration reform. Vice Mayor?
Thank you, Mayor. First of all, a couple of comments to preface this, to give some context for all of this. This letter, back in, I want to say it was September, beginning of September, when I came back from my National League of Cities meeting, I had commented to the City Council that one of the ideas that I had presented to my committee, which is a committee of about 35-40 mayors and council members from around the country that deal with community and economic development issues, was this notion of dealing with the frustrations that we all felt. And just to give you a little bit of history, back in 2000, when I was young and fresh and naive and full of energy and enthusiasm and barely brand new on the council, we had a task force report that came forward. The mayor got it at a council committee. I was sitting right where Tom Rawls is sitting, and he said, I think we need to hand this over to the General Development Committee. Who is the chair of the General Development Committee? And I raised my hand and said, no problem, Mayor. We'll take it, and we'll get this taken care of. And it dealt with issues with day labor, but one of the first recommendations was to work with the federal government to get improve immigration laws and laws regarding hiring and all of those things. And I said, that's fine, we'll go back to D.C., we'll take care of this. And so, in the yes, and Tom's laughing. And I just knew that during the 2 years that I was chair of the General Development Committee, I could take care of this problem. I could solve the problem. How stupid I was. And so then I got on this committee, this Community and Economic Development Steering Committee, and I took it to them as an issue that we needed to address. And the response I got was, Claudia, that's a regional issue, it isn't a national issue. I'm sorry, illegal immigration is not a national issue, and we only do national issues. And that was about 5 years ago, I want to say, that I got that response. Well, about 2 years ago, I was no longer getting that response, and so we got it on the agenda, and Kyle got appointed to an ad hoc committee that came from several NLC committees to address this. And one of the things that we became very aware of as we went to Washington through the years was that their people had taken a posture and they weren't going to move off of that. And therefore, nothing got done. And it was very, very frustrating. So at this last meeting, as we were looking at the policy that NLC had adopted, and we had all had to give some on that policy, I think Kyle would tell you he doesn't agree with everything that's on there. I would tell you I don't agree with everything that's on there, but as my husband says, when we're behind a driver who is blocking traffic, he says, do something even if it's wrong. And I think that we had sort of reached that place. Please do something. What I proposed to my committee was that we all go back to our cities and towns and that we propose to the National League of Cities that they ask all of the cities and towns in the country to write letters to their congressional delegation, asking them, begging them, pleading with them to please move off the dime, talk to each other. We don't care what your political affiliation is. This is a national issue. Immigration is federal, and we need your assistance. I said that at a council meeting, said I was going to go write the letter, went and wrote the letter, was wanting this to be on the agenda a couple of weeks ago. I didn't want it on with this discussion today. That didn't quite happen, and so I apologize. It all got blended together, and then you guys got the letter, and it got out to the press, and none of you other than the mayor had even seen the letter. And so I apologize for that, that somehow your name is affiliated with it. You didn't vote on it. You didn't anything. It's my fault. And by the way, we aren't singling out the Arizona delegation. We have some people who have worked incredibly hard on this issue on the Arizona delegation. It was, I didn't know I was going to have a network moment when I, you know, when I wrote the letter. So I apologize for those that offended. I was not trying to be overly harsh. It spoke to 6 years of frustration. And so I recognize that there have been things that have happened since then that have, that there has been some action that has been taken by Congress since then that makes some of the things in the letter moot, and I think we probably have to go back and rewrite it. I am hoping that the council will agree still to sending a letter, and I need everybody's feedback on what that letter would look like, and if they don't want me to write letters for them anymore, then they need to tell me that too. So that's where it is, Mayor. Thank you.
Okay. I think the letter in its present form probably does not work as and I am pleased with some of our congressional delegation, Hayworth and Flake and McCain and others that tried to bring these issues forward a long time ago. I think some of the, you know, this is the only thing that I'll agree to, and if it's not in the bill, I walk. Created some stalemates for a while between the two House and Senate bills, trying to get them reconciled and get something, a comprehensive plan out there. But at least they've done some steps. I think the border fencing program will help, but that doesn't get completed till the end of 2008, so we're going to have a porous border for a number of years before that's even completed, and then who knows if that'll be successful. We've got a lot of coastline. We've got another border to the north, and I'm not sure we want to be totally fenced in. So I have some issues with that whole deal. I am not sure how far I'm comfortable going as far as trying to gain an expertise on work visas and immigration policy and how the numbers. So I don't know how specific I would be comfortable with making suggestions, because it's just not my expertise. But I would certainly support a letter that says, we've done some steps, but we still do not have a comprehensive immigration policy that is sustainable. And so that would be and continue to work on it. Don't say we've done a wall, so we're done. We still have a lot of people here in the country. We still have a lot of children that are being born to people illegally in the country, and that's a whole issue that I think should be addressed, too. I have different feelings than others on that. So I think the letter to be drafted, or maybe we even do individual letters and forget trying to come as a united council. I'm also comfortable with doing that, because we certainly have that right. I think it's stronger if it comes from the council, and let's try that approach. But good luck on getting something drafted that we'll all agree on. We'll give it a try, though. Let's go to Tom.
Yeah, we're no different than Congress. We're just a smaller scale, right? I appreciate the Vice Mayor's comments about the release of the letter, and I guess I wasn't so concerned about the way that the letter was released or the fact that the press got it. I was not real happy, Mike, with the story that was written, because it made it read much more like this was a council-approved letter, even though it was in a draft form, and it wasn't. But what really offended me, I think, is when the Queen of Blog decided to twist it into a campaign piece for a particular congressional candidate. Just irresponsible. She's smarter than that, and she did it deliberately, and she should be ashamed of herself. She'll know who she is. I don't need to mention her name. Claudia and I talked yesterday about this letter, and she said that she thought it may have been a little bit impolite. I told her that I didn't think it could see impolite from where it was. So I think we have a disagreement about the tone of the letter. I'm all in favor of writing a letter. I'm all in favor of trying to make it a joint letter. I don't think you get very far when you challenge people's underlying goodness, I guess. And you've taught me that to a little bit, Claudia. And I think this letter makes that challenge. You're basically, and so I would need to tone down a lot. I would use the word plead or urge rather than the word demand. I don't think we're in a position to demand anything. And as I said yesterday, Tuesday in jest, I don't think we speak for the vast majority of the American people. I think we speak for ourselves, and I wouldn't use that phrase. I didn't like the phrase that we're somehow giving up our sovereignty, because we can make a sovereign decision not to have a policy and not to protect our borders. So, and I don't think their failure to act has exacerbated the problem. I have my solutions, and I'm not a congressman, so there's no reason for me to disclose them at this point. They're different than many other people, but I think there are things that could be addressed that aren't being addressed. I think there are things that are addressed that aren't being addressed in a meaningful way, and I think there are things that are being addressed that need to move forward. So I'm all in favor of a letter, and I appreciate the fact that the vice mayor has disassociated me from the letter the way she did, and we talked about that as well, and let's take another shot at it.
Okay, Kyle.
I am in favor of having a joint letter that gives a broad statement of we need to do more than just do one leg of the stool. We need to do a comprehensive program without spelling out what all that is, because they're going to have to hash that out. But I really think we need to make a strong statement that while we appreciate what has been done thus far, we need to go much further and put all the rest of the legs on the stool so that it will really work, because one leg will not support will not resolve the issue. So I appreciate being able to, and I think it would be more effective to have a statement from the council as a whole, but I also think that we individually need to write our own letters with our own perspectives and encourage all of our constituency to write letters, because ultimately to fix the problem is going to have to take place in Washington.
Okay. Rex? Want to weigh in on it? And Scott?
I think Kyle said it fairly well for me.
Okay. Scott?
I do support the idea of a letter, and I think it would hold more weight coming from the entire council than individuals. And in the short time that I've been on this council, I've noticed that I address problems, I can recognize problems easier when the neighborhoods themselves come to me and say, Councilmember Summers, we have an issue here that needs your attention, and then I can help focus on that. I believe it's probably the same with our congressional folks. What I would like to see, though, one of the things that is addressed in this letter is looking at a plan to secure our borders and to allow for guest workers. I think that's a national decision, a federal policy. What I'm interested in the letter are trying to take care of some of the obstacles that I talked about that preclude us from doing anything. The difference between a civil crime and a felony, or what was it? I can't remember now.
Criminal offense versus a
civil offense. Those things that people on TV are going, what? To me, it should be easy. You find somebody that's illegal, they're under arrest for something else in the city, you hand them over and they deport them. But it's not that simple, and it should be. It should be. It's ridiculous that it isn't. Identify those obstacles that we have as we go through the process of putting together, I hope, a 287G. There are going to be obstacles there too, Mayor. I think those could be identified, and we bring those to the attention, and hopefully what we get are some, not some huge national policy steps like a guest worker program or a fence, but those little steps that will help local government, our government, the little city of Mesa, to make a difference, whatever difference we can. If we focus on that, I think we'll get some real movement, positive movement. Thank you.
Okay. All right. I think we have direction on that one. Claudia, are you?
I think so. What I heard was that we've taken some steps, but we still don't have a comprehensive immigration policy. Tone down the letter. I'll tone it down a lot, Tom. Actually, it's, you know, from my perspective, it was kind of up there. I don't usually, it really did reflect 6 years of frustration. And once again, and I would agree, I mean, Jeff Flake really went out on a limb to try and find some common ground. And so I'm not trying to attack those specific individuals, and I would concur with what was said about urging our constituents to write, because that was said to us when we were in one of those offices. Mm-hmm. They said, well, you need to get your folks to write to us about this. So I would urge everyone else to write. I heard eliminate the sovereignty line, more than one leg of the stool, comprehensive solution, appreciate what has been done, need to do more, ultimate fixes in Washington, identify and eliminate obstacles to local law enforcement. There was one thing that Tom said that I actually wanted to keep in the letter, and so I guess I do need some direction on that. I do believe that saying that Congress's failure to act has exacerbated the problem is a correct statement. From my perspective, that is a correct statement.
Mayor, if I can. Sure. If I could see that in the context of a rewritten letter,
okay,
we'll take a look at it then. Let's not try to pick out an isolated sentence now.
Okay, well, you would ask for that to be eliminated, so that's what I'm bringing
up. Let's take a look at it.
Okay. All right, I'll give it another try. Now, legally, I do another draft, and my next draft hits the paper, and, you know, let me. Deb, you want to address that at all?
Vice Mayor, we have to be a little careful because of the open meeting law. We cannot exchange ideas or edit the document outside of a public meeting. So I will work with the Vice Mayor. We can send out information and make sure there's just not the back and forth drafting of this letter.
And ultimately, I suppose, if it's so bad that that there aren't four people who want to bring it back for a vote on it, that will be the determining factor, huh?
Well, we won't know if there's four people to bring it back. You'll be bringing it back.
Well, unless you don't put it on the agenda.
No.
I don't have the ability as a single council member. You do, Mayor, or it takes four council members?
Three.
Three? Three. Okay, sorry.
Not a majority of you to have a
legal right.
meeting.
Yes. Thank you.
Tom.
Two things on the same issue. I think this is a good time just to point out that if it does get released to the press again before we have a chance to discuss it, that the story might get written in a way that doesn't suggest that it is a council going after, or that a council has made the decision, or that the council is doing this. It's a draft letter from Claudia for our consideration, and she may not even agree with everything in it. She's just putting it in there to try to build a consensus. So that's my first comment. Second comment I want to make, Mayor, is I sort of felt like Claudia a little bit. I was very concerned about the direction that this meeting was going to take today and the impact that it might have. I thought it had the potential for turning into a farce, turning into a political charade. I think the only thing that turned out to be a farce and a charade was my hat, and I'm really happy about that. That's why I wore it. I wanted to try to bring some humor to the meeting so that it didn't degenerate into something that I was afraid that it could. I think you set the agenda and conducted the meeting in a way that precluded that. I thought it was a good, thoughtful discussion. Not sure I would have had it 1 month before the election, but that's a different issue. I appreciate the fact that it got on the agenda and taken care of the way that it got taken care of today.
Okay. All right, that concludes item number three. Let's go on to four, which is appointments to boards and committees. All right, have a motion and a second for approval. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Same. All right. Okay. I'll excuse you. Hear reports on meetings and our conferences attended. Yeah, I think we can probably skip that item unless anyone has a pressing one. Then scheduling and meetings and general information.
Mayor, with the chairman of the fire committee. But walking out the door, we will be postponing that meeting. So, which I think we know some of us have another obligation we need to get to. But we'll have to get back with the members of that committee and discuss that. But again, just a reminder, we have October 12th study session at 7:30, and that will be followed by an audit and finance committee meeting. We have the Monday, October 16th study session and council meeting. A reminder again of the Wednesday, October 18th joint Mesa City Council, Mesa Public Schools Board meeting, which will be at 7:30 a.m. at the Mesa Public School Administration Building, which is there off of Stapley.
Thank you.
Okay, Tom.
On the issue of meetings, this seems to be a particularly good time to let you know that I will be in Central America speaking Spanish and drinking cerveza and watching beers or watching birds on the 19th and the 26th October. I will not be here for the study sessions on the 19th and the 26th.
That gives us enough notice to put in whatever agenda item.
Exactly right. I knew you would want to, and that's where I will be.
Okay. All right. Do we have any requests to speak this morning?
Yes, Mayor. We have three speakers that may or may not be here.
Right.
The first one is Dana Jordan.
This is an opportunity for the audience to address the council for up to 3 minutes. Dana. Right there in front. Grab one of those little skinny mics and pull it up towards you.
Thank you, Mayor and Vice Mayor and Council, for the opportunity to address you. Mm-hmm. I would have to say that I appreciate you guys doing something, because illegal immigration is a big, big problem in our area. I live in the latest opportunity zone, and they were saying that the occupancy is like 9.6 people per house or apartment. That's a lot of people. You know, our neighborhood is overrun with people selling stuff out of shopping carts and all that kind of stuff. Something needs to be done, and I appreciate you guys at least addressing it and doing something. The one concern I have with the matricular card is that it's an unsecured form of ID. I understand the Costco card and all that kind of stuff, but the police using that, if you read what the Mexican government actually wants for you to get that card, it's basically a note from home. It's a note from somebody saying, yeah, he was born here, and there's no documents backing that form of ID up. I was involved in an accident a little while back where the lady had no ID of any kind, no insurance, no nothing, 4 kids in the car, no car seats. The officer took her thumbprint, she drove away, and I fixed my own car. You know, the last time I got my house got broken into, you said that there's a lot of crime and stuff. The last time I got broken into, I found the guy. I chased him down. It took me 7 hours. I put the handcuffs on him. I waited for the police to show up because it was just property crime. It was no big deal. And I could see that it wasn't going to be anywhere. I got the guy the same day. So, and there's something that needs to be done. I live near Broadway and Gilbert. 2 days ago, I was at the M&M Market. I'm trying to back out after I bought a sandwich, and I'm leaving there. And I couldn't leave because I had to wait for a drug deal to go down. This guy pulls up. Guy comes out, does this in the window, and the guy leaves, looks in his baggie, and he walks away. Something's wrong. Something needs to be done. And I appreciate you guys addressing it.
Thank you.
So you want that?
Next speaker, Philip Austin. I think he left. And Bob Park. Bob Park here.
Okay, thank you. That's it for the study session. We have a motion and second to adjourn. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
We're adjourned.